Guess who's back in the motherfucking house?
Hello. Welcome to episode 88.
Was I supposed to do like a callback thing there?
Yeah, you're supposed to say, "With a big fat dick for your motherfucking mouth."
Is that really lyrics?
That's really lyrics.
Oh, wow.
Anyway,
welcome. What is that from?
God, I don't remember right now. It's some rap song. Wow, I'm really up on my facts.
Sorry, I didn't do the like call and reply thing.
Good. Well, we were talking about... Never mind. So after a three-week hiatus, we're back.
Yes.
And this episode is going to be very heavy on the first part.
The best part. Did I say that out loud?
The what have you been watching part, because it's been 3 weeks and, you know, we have a tendency, well, to try and watch a movie every night, but...
Yes.
Sometimes doesn't happen.
No.
So the topic is Revisit Revision, which is basically inspired by me rewatching Throw Mama from the Train and really, really enjoying it this time. I thought, why don't we do... list like 5 movies each,
yeah,
of stuff that we, when we originally watched it, we either didn't like it or liked it, and when we rewatched it, our opinion changed.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the spirit of the episode should be more of the didn't like it and then liked it,
which is what I most, which is pretty much 90%.
Yeah, unfortunately, we couldn't come up. Well, I certainly couldn't come up with enough.
I have 4 out of my 5 are positive.
3 out of my 5 are positive.
Well, there you go. See, you're at 60%. I'm at 80%. It's all good.
There you go. We're still passing.
So let's... You're barely passing. You're like those guys who hang out in the smoker pit.
I did hang out in the smoker pit.
And then maybe every once in a while you come in and do a test so that you can get your D plus.
Well, no, I got good grades.
All right.
Not that good.
Good, but not that good. Passable enough to get you graduated.
Yeah, exactly. No, I... Anyway.
Dude, you're accredited. I think you did better in school than you're giving yourself credit
That's
for.
That's true. Well, I'm always down on myself.
Anyway. Who wants to start?
I'll start.
You got more, so you start.
I got a lot of quickies, though.
Oh, yeah.
So,
Don't know where that
Okay, I'm going to start by pairing two up right away.
Okay, do it.
Okay.
What do you got?
I'm going to pair up two movies that either took place or had part of the movie take place in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Right?
How random is this?
Random is that?
Now,
random is it that I watch these movies back to back not knowing this?
Get the fuck out
I'm
of
totally
here.
Serious. I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
So like a title card came up telling you where it was and you're like, wait a minute, I just watched a movie set there.
Yeah, let me explain.
Okay. All right, do it.
Okay, actually, I can tie another one into this, too.
Oh, we're going for a threefer? What are you, Vince D'Amato?
Okay. The first one I watched, I think you've seen this one, was called Atari Game Over.
Yes.
Directed by Zach Penn from 2014.
Yep.
Zach Penn is a kind of a nerd like us, and he's written a bunch of superhero movies.
Yeah.
And
he also wrote PCU.
Oh, did he write PCU?
Yes.
Right.
And I love me some PCU.
Yeah, he seems like an okay guy. I mean, he's, and he wrote Ready Player One.
Yeah, I watched the, that incident at Loch Ness he did with, where with he co-starred with
Werner Herzog.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know about that, but.
I didn't like it either.
Yeah, he is pretty nerdy though, so.
He is.
He's one of us.
Yeah, and he was super nerdy in this. But, so this one's about, it's a documentary about him going to Alamogordo, New Mexico,
yep,
where there's this urban legend that there's a garbage dump.
Well, it's not an urban legend.
Well, at the beginning of the movie, it is an urban legend.
It was never an urban legend.
It was an urban legend. Okay. That's why the movie happened.
I always thought it was
Are you
like,
sure you saw the movie?
I did.
So the premise of the movie...
I always thought it was just a sure known fact that it was there and someone just had to go look for it.
Well, no, I just watched the movie and the whole movie, they're like, it's an urban legend. We want to find out if it's an urban legend, so they dig up the garbage dump.
Fair enough.
Spoiler alert.
Darn.
So there was... Okay, so before I got sidetracked, so the premise of the movie is there was this urban legend that Atari buried... like thousands and thousands of copies of their E.T. video game because it was a massive failure.
And it kind of caused the video game crash.
Yeah, tanked the company and made a big impact on the video game world back in the 80s.
Yep. I remember playing this game on my Atari.
Do you? You had it?
I don't have it still, but fuck, dude, it sucked.
Did it?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
You didn't know what the hell you were doing half the time.
That's what I got out of the documentary. Yeah. So they actually go to Alamogordo, New Mexico, and locate the garbage dump, and then like they're spending time like trying to figure out exactly where these may or may not be buried, and eventually they start excavating to try and find out if the games are actually there. That's all I was expecting from this movie. Now, what I wasn't expecting is that it's also a documentary about Atari, which I thought was the most interesting part of this movie.
I agree.
And I had no idea it was going to be like that. And I really liked a lot of the characters they went over, in particular Howard Warshaw, who created the E.T. game. And he also created another really famous game called Something's Revenge. Yar's Revenge, yeah. And I really like that.
I like Yar's Revenge.
Yeah, I've never played that. I was an Intellivision guy.
You're like Ange.
Oh, where are you?
Yeah, she's an Intellivision girl.
Yeah, I had an Intellivision back in the day, but I do remember this era, but I thought it was really cool, like seeing all these guys and how they were kind of like rock stars and they just kind of partied all the time, and it looked like a really fun place to work. It actually reminded me of when you were describing the National Lampoon documentary. That's kind of what I envisioned National Lampoon would have been like, was what this was like. And it looked like a really cool place to work. So that was a real bonus, getting the whole history of Atari, because I thought it was quite compelling, and just sort of what happened to all these guys. And it does kind of follow Warshaw, as an adult now, and kind of what happened to him, and as he's waxing nostalgic on his past. So that was pretty cool. It also had Ernest Cline was in it, the writer of Ready Player One, the novel. And
does he show up with his DeLorean?
He shows up with his DeLorean, and George R. R. Martin was interviewed in this a little bit, and it was just kind of a really cool little short documentary.
Yeah,
but
like 50 minutes.
Yeah, just over an hour. But it was a lot of fun. I really dug it, and I just watched it because it was coming off Netflix, and I'm like, oh, I better watch this. But yeah, I also did see, because I also recently watched read Ready Player One. Which I really enjoyed, and Chris talked about that a long, long time ago on one of the episodes.
Yeah.
So we both really liked the novel, and I also went and checked out the movie, which I thought was really fun. I mean, I don't know a lot of other directors that could pull it off the way Spielberg did, so I think it was really smart picking Spielberg as the director of this film. I know Chris is a little cautious about it because of all the CG. And I was too, but at the end of the day, the novel takes place in a virtual reality world, and it worked. I thought it really worked. It's not going to be my favorite movie of the year or anything, but it was a lot of fun. Took me, it was a real breezy 2 hours and 20 minutes, which is weird for me to say. yes. But I thought it really made some good choices on changing the novel. A lot of people are really against that. But when I was watching things unravel in this movie, I was thinking about the book, and I'm like, okay, well, we could have shown someone sitting there playing Joust, or we could do a big car action scene, and it was a good choice.
Well, the thing, too, is that's another thing. Like, when I read that book, I was like, there's no way they can make a movie out of this book.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much going on for pop culture references and so on and so forth. And then when I heard that Spielberg was making, I'm like, okay, that's a pretty good choice to make it as a guy like Spielberg. But I'm really cold on the movie. I just don't really want to see it because I liked that book so much that I just want to keep that memory to myself. I don't know. It's hard to explain. I don't want to contextualize it on a movie screen. I want to just keep my memory of reading the book and really liking the book, because I didn't particularly like his second book that much.
Right.
So I just want to keep that to myself, I guess.
Right. I mean, the thing I kind of thought was cool about the way it was done is that it had some parts of the book, but they changed it quite drastically. But in a way that I almost felt like I was watching the same story, but told a different way.
Right.
So, and it was so different, yet the same. Like, I didn't feel like I was comparing it to the book through the whole movie. I felt like I was watching a different experience, which is kind of neat. And, like, you know, there's so many books where, you know, we're real purists about the way it should be exactly like the book. But I thought going and making all these decisions and changing it so much actually really worked for the movie.
Well,
so
he also co-wrote the script, I think.
Ernest Cline, yeah, yeah. And Zach Penn. So, yeah, it was good.
Okay.
But going back to Alamogordo, New Mexico, the next film I watched was a movie that I wasn't quite sure about, and it's actually kind of ironic that it's on this episode, because this is definitely a movie that I think I'm going to revisit in the future and really like it. But watching it the first time, not so much. And it's a movie called This Must Be the Place from 2011, directed by Paolo Sorrentino. And this is, you're going to know exactly what this is as soon as I say this.
I know, it sounds familiar.
This is a movie where Sean Penn plays an aging goth.
Oh, okay, yep.
A la Robert Smith.
I know it, yep.
Who, he's like kind of a shut-in. He had something happen in his musical career that caused him to stop playing music. So he's basically this rich dude who's living with his wife in a mansion and is really weird and really soft-spoken and almost childlike and pretty unlikable, like, I gotta admit. And then his father dies, so he flies over to the States to basically say goodbye. He says to say goodbye to his dad. And then he learns that his dad was haunted by his experience in a concentration camp in World War II. So then Sean Penn's character decides he's going to go and find the Nazi war criminal who made his dad's life so shitty. And I thought, wow, this is a really, really interesting premise. And Sean Penn playing like a Robert Smith type character, I thought was a really interesting choice. But yeah, I didn't really like his delivery of the character. Like, I was kind of, like I said, I was just kind of annoyed by him throughout most of the movie. That being said, one of the producers of this movie really got me interested when the opening credits were playing, because it's Andrea Occipinti. And he is he was an Italian actor who was in, like, he was one of the leads in Lucio Fulci's Conquest, and also in like A Blade in the Dark, and I think he had a part in New York Ripper. And so I know him from this. So I was like, oh, wow, that's a weird person to be involved with this movie. So, I mean, you know, I am kind of liking the new stuff coming from Italy. So I sort of went with this. It really felt like a David Lynch movie. Like, it was just kind of a really weird road movie with all kinds of, like, strange characters popping up. We had a really cool cameo from David Byrne from the Talking Heads.
Sounds like it could be a David Lynch meets Gus Van Sant movie.
Yeah, like, it really had that kind of art house feel. Well, not even a kind of art house feel. It had a total art house feel to it. But, you know, it was sort of meandering along, and, you know, it started out in... I can't remember where he's met up with his dad and then went to the funeral, but then he went on like this cross country trek trying to find this war criminal, including a drop off in Alamogordo, New Mexico, which is, yeah, was super bizarre when I just literally watched Ready Player One right before this, or Atari Game Over right before this. But, you know, Judd Hirsch shows up. Frances McDormand plays his wife. Sean Penn's wife. Harry Dean Stanton shows up. David Byrne shows up playing himself in the best scene of the movie, for sure. The movie is, the title of the movie is taken from the title of a Talking Heads song. And, you know, it's got some really great dialogue. There's one scene in a restaurant where Penn delivers a line that, you know, I think will always probably stick with me. So it has, he had some really great moments that way. Cinematography was top notch. It was just really, really slow. And I just was having a bit of trouble with the character that was bringing me through this movie. But pretty ballsy move by Penn to play a character like this. I mean, just even the poster image is just so weird. A big picture of Sean Penn, like with a big Robert Smith wig and eye makeup and everything. Yeah. And at his age, it just looks really crazy. And, it was interesting, but, I'm not in a hurry to go back to it, but like I said, I do think it's one, if I watched it in 10 years again, I'd probably really like it.
Hmm.
So this must be the place.
Huh. Yeah, I remember seeing the box art for this and thinking, maybe it's too weird for me to watch. Just because I'm not used to seeing Sean Penn looking that way.
Yeah, it was weird seeing him. And he looks that way through the whole movie. Yeah.
Okay. So my turn.
Yep.
So I'm going to pair up two of mine now.
Okay.
And the reason I'm doing that is because these are two movies that I've never seen before that are older movies. They don't really go together contextually, I guess, but let's go for it anyway. I watched 1976's Car Wash, for starters, and I had never seen that movie.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with the Rolls Royce song, obviously. I know that Richard Pryor's in the movie. Apart from that, I didn't know much apart from it had a fucking car wash in it. So this is a day in the life comedy set in Los Angeles. At a car wash, which is predominantly staffed by African Americans. The owner's this old white guy. He's got the secretary who is kind of flirty with everybody. And I found out when I was looking into it, I didn't write her name down, but she was in All the Marbles as one of the bad girl wrestlers.
Oh, really?
So I was like, that's sweet.
Yeah.
Richard Pryor is in this, but he's only in it for like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Playing this like preacher guy called Daddy Rich. He brings along the Pointer Sisters.
Oh, yeah.
And the Pointer Sisters get to sing a song called You Gotta Believe, which I was like tapping my toe to. And I was like, yeah, this is sweet. And I was like, where's all the music in this movie? I have that. And then I have a sweet montage of the car wash opening and all the people who work there dancing to Car Wash and, you know, getting down and everything. I'm like, I want more of this.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty fun movie. Like, it's not much happens because it's just a day in the life. It's like basically 10 hours that this car wash is open. It follows the people who work there.
Yeah.
So not much happens. It's not particularly that funny, but it's engaging. That's the thing. Like, this is a cast. You got, like, you know, George Carlin's in it, like I mentioned, just playing some cabbie. You got Garrett Morris from Saturday Night Live. You got a really young Bill Duke playing like a guy who's discovered the Islam Nation and now is like, oh, I hate everything about society, you know, fight the man and all that stuff. So he's in it. Antonio Fargas from Shaft of Foxy Brown's in this.
Huggy Bear.
Yep. The guy I like the most is Franklin AJ playing TC. He's got this giant fro, and I fucking love giant fros.
Yeah.
And he's a wannabe like comic book artist. He made up this character called The Fly and how he's going to come and save everyone. And he's got this thing for a girl who works in a diner across the street that they all go for lunch with. And he's always trying to get with her. He's always trying to win radio contests so he can get tickets to the big show to take her. And he's just a really fun, engaging character. And he's the guy I kind of focused on mostly in the movie because, you know, that fro, first scene of him's walking in with a leisure suit with the big giant fro looking all slick and cool. And I'm like, yeah. So he was on it. He was in Convoy as one of the truck drivers. He was also in this, before this, he was in this movie with Stockard Channing called Sweet Revenge.
Okay.
Which sounds like a, like, woman scorned kind of revenge movie, which I want to seek out.
Right.
I know it's out on Warner Archive DVD or something, so I might have to buy that. And the only other thing I really want to talk about is Tim Thomerson's in this briefly from Trancers and other various B-movies I really like. He's kind of like the studly guy who the secretary like gets the hots for. It's written by Joel Schumacher.
Oh, wow.
Before he started directing, you know, he did DC Cab, Lost Boys, Flatliners,
Robin.
Yeah, or
Batman and Robin. Sorry,
Batman and Robin and Batman Forever. He did both of those. But I mean, he's a guy who has made a lot of movies, and to see his name as the writer on this, I was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
and directed by a guy called Michael Schultz, who's his other movie that I really know that I have seen that I really liked was Coolie High from the year before, which is another one of those kind of slice of life, urban high school kind of movies that I really dig.
Yeah,
and he's still actually working a lot in television, and to this day he's directing episodes of that Black Lightning show right now.
Oh really?
So he's an African-American director as well, and I don't know, I just was compelled one day. I was in the record, like the music store in the mall, and I was like, they have 2 for $10 DVDs, and I'm like, oh, Car Wash, I've never seen that. So I was like, okay, come home with me. And yeah, it's pretty fun. You've seen Car Wash, haven't you?
I have. I didn't. It didn't really do much for me.
Like, but I don't think it's amazing, but I think it's just like, if you want to put it on for an hour and a half, it's entertaining.
I think you're right on, though. Like, the opening scene is, I thought the whole movie was going to be like that. And then it was like, I just wanted that to come back.
Well, because you got all the guys, like, they're showing up at work, and they're, like, getting dressed in the dressing room, and there's these two guys who bust in, and they're, like, big, leisure suits, and start disco dancing and singing a song because they want to, like, break into the music industry, and everyone laughs at them, and then TC's there talking about his superhero, and Bill Duke shows up eventually talking about Islam, and then they open, and they're, they're dancing around, spraying cars, and having a good old time, and I'm like, I want more of that, because I did kind of get a little bit, it did get a little tiresome.
Yeah, exactly.
In the last half hour or so.
Yeah.
But for a 70s flick that I haven't seen.
Yeah.
It was good. It was 90 minutes, turned my brain off.
Yeah.
Perfectly fine.
I agree. Nothing wrong with it.
The other one I watched is a movie that I'm sure you're going to have a good old time making fun of me about. It's a 1988 movie called Mystic Pizza.
Aw. Yeah, I put it in my to-watch pile.
Yeah. Did you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I hadn't seen this. I know it's considered a chick flick.
Yeah.
But I have a real soft spot for these, like, post-high school, small-town, coming-of-age type movies.
Yeah.
So, like, I like a movie like 1989, Staying Together with Sean Astin and Dermot Mulroney. I like that movie. All those kind of movies like that, I just have a soft spot for. And this one's about three
high school... You need to watch Breaking Away. I gotta just throw that in.
That too. But this is like... three high school friends played by Julia Roberts, Lily Taylor, and Annabeth Gish. And they all work together in like this Mystic Pizza. It's a pizza place. But they're like, at the same time, they have these various problems because they're, in that in-between phase where they've finished high school and they want to move on to university or college or whatever. They don't know where their life's really going.
Yeah.
And each one has their own issues,
Kind of like me now.
Still? All these years later, Josh?
I think I got stuck in the 22 thing.
Yeah, dude, it's like 20, it's over 20 years since you graduated high school. I don't know what's wrong with you. But, like Julia Roberts plays like this girl who's like, she kind of gets caught up with this rich touristy guy, and she's considered kind of a tramp in a way by some of the townsfolk. And Lily Taylor's boyfriend is played by Vincent D'Onofrio, and he really wants to get married.
Right.
And she kind of is hesitant, so her story's kind of about that. And then Annabeth Gish is kind of the one who's smart enough to go to university or college and doesn't know if she wants to, and she gets involved with like this older English professor type guy. Because she's hired to babysit his daughter. So that's basically their plot lines, and it just goes through that. It's set during a summertime, really. Right. And, this I never really understood why Julia Roberts was a thing in the 90s. Like, Pretty Woman and everything after that.
Flatliners.
But, I think Julia Roberts is okay.
Yeah.
But I never got why she was like this it girl for a while.
Yeah.
This movie, I get it.
Oh, okay.
This movie, I understand now. Because she's really charming in this. And she's really, always has this bright smile on her face through a lot of it and everything. And I'm like, okay, I get it now. Oh. I get why Pretty Woman made her into this star.
Yeah.
And I didn't before this movie.
Have you seen Pretty Woman?
I have.
Yeah.
Oh, I saw it in theaters with my parents.
Oh.
Ah, sweet. But I get it now. The only other thing, it's like a coming-of-age movie, has a couple funny moments, has a few dramatic moments that work pretty good. I enjoyed this movie.
Nice.
I thought it was fun at times, but I also thought all three of the characters, I cared about what happened to them. I really like Lily Taylor.
Yeah.
I like Annabeth Gish in the little things I've seen her in, so it worked for me. Worth mentioning here, directed by Donald Petrie. His first movie and his best movie, because look at the shit he made after this, dude. He made Grumpy Old Men,
ooh,
Opportunity Knocks with Dana Carvey,
ouch,
and other kind of forgettable bad comedies.
Yeah.
And it's co-written by Amy Holden Jones, who us genre fans will know as being the writer of Slumber Party Massacre.
Oh, nice.
So worth noting for that too. So yeah, Mystic Pizza, I actually quite dug it.
Cool.
So,
all right. Well, I'm going to pair up a couple more here.
Oh, we're pairing them all today?
Well, we're going to pair up some documentaries.
All right, do it.
Okay.
You pair up some documentaries and wait. I'll follow it with a documentary.
Do I have two documentaries? Maybe I'm lying.
Well, you had the Atari one.
No, I already talked about that one. Oh, no, I'm lying. I'm not going to pair it up. I'm not going to pair up. But I am going to talk about a documentary.
Talk about your documentary, then I'll talk about mine.
Okay, I watched a movie called Respectable, The Mary Millington Story. Yeah, I know who's Mary Millington, right? I don't know either. So
if you don't know who she is, why'd you watch it?
Because she's a porn star.
Oh, okay. All right.
Of course.
Okay.
So this is a 2016 documentary directed by Simon Sheridan. He also wrote a biography about Mary Millington that came out through Fab Press. And I always am interested, as we've talked about, even on the last episode, I'm always interested in the adult film world and just sort of what's going on there and like what makes these people tick. Even just your story about Savannah, Shannon Wilsey that you were talking about last week, like I just find there's all these like interesting stories and the whole like John Holmes Wonderland thing. There's yeah, a lot of crazy shit that was going on in that world. So Mary Millington, I did not know anything about before I watched this. So she was a British porn star.
I figured because yeah, it was a Fab Press book.
Yeah. So we focus so much on American porn that we don't really, I don't know anything about British porn stars. But I
know about Samantha Fox. That's about it.
Touch V. I want to feel.
I want to have some fun.
Yeah. 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 She was, I had a poster of her when I was, anyway.
I think every male did.
Yeah, it was a really, I've seen the poster recently and I'm like, wow, I'm really surprised my parents let this ride. And
I see Samantha Fox from back there and I'm like, wow, I'm really surprised. I thought she was hot.
Really?
Yeah.
And I was also really surprised I could actually get the poster off the wall. But that's another story.
What? Okay. Anyway. Okay.
So Mary Millington, so she was this really cute blonde that, you know, as with a lot of porn stars, she got into it. You know, she was, had a bit of a fucked up childhood and then, you know, started getting some pictures taken and one thing led to another. And eventually she started acting in loops and then eventually, started acting in feature films. She was discovered by a guy named David Sullivan, and he was kind of like the Bob Guccione or Hugh Hefner, more like the Bob Guccione or Larry Flint of England. And he was he was interviewed quite extensively throughout the documentary. Kind of sleazy, kind of reminded me of the IT Crowd.
Yeah.
You know the sleazy boss?
Yeah.
That guy. Reminded me of that guy.
Really?
Yeah. But she, she was, you know, doing her thing. She was in a couple of B-movies that I have heard of, actually. One was called Come Play With Me. Now, I have heard of it because it was one of the biggest kind of exploitation-y B-movies, like sexploitation movies in out of England in the 70s. And another one called The Playbirds. So I had heard of both of these. And I'm not sure exactly why, but I did know the titles did ring a bell. She then eventually opened a sex shop, and pretty interesting. I mean, like, she did a lot of stuff for, like, freedom of speech and, you know, defending porn, you know, and especially in England at that time where, you know, they were really, you know, this was when the video nasties were all going on and they were really into censorship. So, you know, pretty ballsy, this woman, like, doing all this stuff. And she opened a sex shop because she was trying to promote that, you know, if people want to have sex, if people want to do these things, they should be able to do it. And so she'd actually, you know, work in the shop that she owned. So, like, all her fans would, like, go to the shop and, like, meet her, and she'd be walking around topless and stuff. So pretty kind of a really kind of bold woman.
Well, yeah, and the thing about that is, too, is that if you know about video nasties and all that stuff, like, there was a lot of censorship in England during that time.
Big
so, yeah,
time.
That is pretty ballsy because, like, you don't hear about it now, but, like, in the 70s and even the early 80s, the British censors were pretty brutal, like, more brutal than anything that was going on in North America, because, like, you can look at a video nasty list and you'll be like, why the hell did they ban this movie?
Exactly.
Or you can look at, there's this playlist that I've been listening to of songs, and they're songs that were banned by the BBC.
Right.
That wouldn't get played. And some of them you're just like, why did this song get banned?
Right.
Like, you know, sure, I might understand why, I Don't Like Mondays by the Boomtown Rats is on there. Maybe I understand why they might have banned that. But then there'll be songs that are about, like, going and fighting a war that they banned, which really shouldn't have been.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is definitely, you know, a fight the power kind of power play.
Yeah, definitely a tough time to be, like, fighting for, like, porn rights.
Yeah.
So, you know, I thought it was quite a compelling story just learning about this woman. And, you know, unfortunately, she, you know, got into drugs and, of course, the inevitable downward spiral. And that's all covered in the movie. And then she died very, very young at age 33 of a supposed suicide drug overdose. But, of course, that's questionable when you watch the movie. So I thought it was really interesting. I wrote down, I like that stuff like this exists, because I wouldn't have even known about her. And, you know, I think it's kind of cool that, you know, someone took the time to, like, make a feature film and write a book about this woman that's kind of being forgotten, and, you know, allowing someone like me to learn about her. And, I thought it was a pretty cool little documentary, that was, you know, just showed up on Netflix. And, it was good. Don't have a lot more to say about it. I do want to take a look at Come Play With Me, which looks like one of those, like, Carry On movies with tits.
I have to admit, I kind of like the Carry On movies.
Yeah, so
they're kind of like Benny Hill ish.
Yeah, so it's like those with some boobs and bums. So
bums. You even use the proper British term.
Some bums,
bums.
Yeah,
so some fannies.
But it was interesting, and it's pretty cool learning about someone you just had no idea about, and kind of what she did, and but yeah, tragic at the same time.
Is that still on Netflix, or was it
unfortunately
coming
out? Not?
No. So
Netflix has gone crazy in the last, like, couple of weeks,
like taking stuff down. When did she die? Like, what year was it? Do you have that written down?
1979.
Oh, okay, so okay.
Yeah.
So really quite a while ago.
Yeah, very. Yeah, this, like, was like the early days,
like,
of porn.
Almost 40 years later, and someone's making a documentary. That's, that's pretty.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. Yeah.
It's pretty impressive, I guess.
Yeah. All right. This woman, like, apparently was, like, the biggest thing in England. Like I have no idea. I just don't know, right? Like, I mean, I think of the Sex Pistols when I think of England, or the Beatles, right? Like,
The thing is, in the 70s from England, you don't think about porn because of the censorship.
Yeah. But I think just even as, like, a titillating actress, like, I'm just trying to, like, was she, like, the Suzanne Somers of England? Like, I don't know, right? I don't really have context.
Maybe she was more like the Marilyn Burns of England.
Marilyn Burns?
Not Marilyn Burns, Marilyn Chambers.
Marilyn Chambers,
sorry,
yeah.
Not the Texas Chainsaw Girl.
Yeah.
Marilyn Chambers.
Yeah. Anyway, interesting stuff.
All right. Let's talk about my documentary then.
Okay.
So this is a documentary that I watched on Shudder. It is out on Blu-ray from Synapse. So remember, like, last year or the year before, Synapse put out Just Desserts, The Making of Creepshow?
Yeah.
So that was, like, one of those ones where it was produced for an extra special feature and Warner Brothers didn't want to use it.
Right.
So it ended up coming out on Blu-ray. They've also released this one on Blu-ray recently. It's called Unearthed and Untold, The Path to Pet Cemetery.
Right.
From 2017, directed by John Campapiano and Justin White. So this is basically a love letter to Mary Lambert's 1989 adaptation of the Stephen King novel, which is a movie, admittedly, that I like but do not love.
Yeah, it seems like a weird movie to make a feature documentary.
It's apparently got enough of a following that they called for this. They have people in this movie who have Pet Cemetery fucking tattoos and stuff.
Really?
Yeah. So it's kind of weird because I've always thought that Pet Cemetery's the movie was fine. Like I like it enough, but it's not one of those movies where I'm like, man, I wish there was a feature length documentary yeah, exactly. about this movie because I want to learn everything.
Yeah.
The problem with this is that you do not learn everything. Okay. My problem with this documentary, apart from the fact that maybe because I'm not so into Pet Cemetery, I didn't quite get as much out of it as someone who really is would, but there's no involvement from King in this.
Oh, yeah.
There's no film clips in this.
Oh.
And there's these really bad artist rendered recreations of scenes from the movie instead of film clips.
Weird.
And there's camcorder behind the scenes footage that's really blurry that they use from time to time. So right there, you're showing your budget and you're showing me that you probably didn't get clearance to use film clips. So you're kind of winging it.
Huh.
So that right there kind of took me out a little bit.
Yeah.
Another thing that kind of took me out a little bit, there's two things. Number one is that it doesn't seem to focus enough on the things that matter. It seemed to gloss over a lot of stuff. Like, it glosses over, you know, parts of the filming process, which is what I'm most interested in.
Yeah.
It glosses over the music section of this. Like, they'll be like, oh, here's the composer who made the score. Everyone seems to love the score. Let's talk to him for 30 seconds and move on. Oh, here's Marky Ramone talking about the Pet Cemetery song they made for the song. Let's talk to him for 10 seconds and move on.
Oh.
So that we can go back to more footage with one of the set decorators. They talk to one of the set decorators of the movie for a long fucking time.
Huh.
So she'll be like, oh, this is how I made the Pet Cemetery look like this. And there'll be just this really long focus on set decoration than there should be in a movie about a making of.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, they do get an impressive amount of people interviewed here. You know, they get all the main actors in it. Well, apart from Fred Gwynne, obviously, because he's passed away. But they have
the little kid. The little kid in it.
Yep, they have him. They have Denise Crosby. They have Dale Midkiff. They have all those people in it. They have Mary Lambert in it talking about the movie. So they've got everybody who matters doing interviews.
Right.
Great. So there is some good information thrown out there. Another problem I have, apart from not focusing on what needs to be focused on, is that the directors show up on screen to propel the narrative of their documentary forward by explaining things to the audience.
Oh, yeah.
Which should never happen in a documentary.
Yeah.
Like, the director should, unless you're Michael Moore or, you know, that guy who made Super Size Me who has to be in front of the camera.
Yeah.
You don't do it.
Right.
Especially not on a making of a film.
Yeah.
You just don't do it. It's just not, it's kind of like not accepted, I guess. Yeah. I don't know how to explain it. No, I hear you. So, there's those problems. Still, it's an acceptable middle-of-the-road documentary. It shouldn't have got its own Blu-ray release from Synapse because it is really just a glorified DVD extra.
Right, yeah, that's what it sounds like.
So, you know, if you're into Pet Cemetery, I can see you getting more out of this than I did, like I said. For me, it's just one of those like, oh, I watched it. It was pretty good. I know a little bit more about Pet Cemetery going in, even though I kind of didn't want to.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said, I watched it on Shudder. I wouldn't recommend buying the Blu-ray unless you're a huge fan. But if you can stream it like I did, go for it.
Right.
And it's not as bad as some of those feature-length documentaries I've seen on other horror releases.
Yeah.
But it's not nearly as good as the stuff that Arrow's doing or Shout's doing on their releases. So it's just one of those ones where if you dig Pet Cemetery a lot, watch it.
Right.
If you're kind of interested in it, watch it. If you don't like it that much, stay away from it.
Yeah, got it. So
that's Unearthed and Untold, The Path to Pet Cemetery.
Ooh.
Ooh.
All right. Well, I'm going to mix some more together.
All right.
Because these are going to be short-ish.
Make a stew.
So more Netflix drops.
Jeez,
coming
is that
up.
All you did? Watch stuff they were taking off Netflix?
I did watch a lot because I was like, fuck, these are all coming off like in the next like 4 days. So this is why I watched so much. I don't think I would have watched this much if that didn't happen.
All right.
First one's called Preservation.
Okay.
Directed by Christopher Denham.
Shit, I think that was on my watch list. I didn't know that was coming down.
Yeah, he was an actor in movies like The Bay. He was one of the leads in The Bay and also in Argo. And he also directed a movie called Home Movie with Adrian Pastor from a number of years ago.
Okay.
So this is a story of three people that go, a woman and her husband and her husband's brother go camping in the woods and then get stalked by some teens a la The Strangers.
And Eden Lake and stuff?
I don't remember. You know, everyone's talking about Eden Lake these days, I feel like. And I've seen it, and it didn't do anything for me. I got to rewatch that one.
Well, you know, I mean, it sounds similar because in Eden Lake, they go to the countryside and they
isn't it like a cult in Eden Lake or something?
No, it's teenagers. It's like hoodies.
I got to see that again, yeah.
I remember liking it, but I don't remember tons about it either.
Yeah, I remember. It just feels like a lot of people are talking about how great that movie is. And maybe I should have watched it for this episode.
Maybe.
But yeah, no, it's just, yeah, it's like, you know, the three people in there, the three people camping, and then there's these three teenagers in like ski masks stalking them.
Okay.
And it was okay. I mean, yeah, this is what I mean. I'm just going to be quick about these. Like, I kind of was expecting this to be, I thought this was going to be more like a wilderness survival thing, like that bear one, Backcountry.
I really
like that. Yeah, like I was kind of expecting more of that. Like, I was kind of shocked when it was like, oh, it's a hunting humans type thing going on here. It had a few decent surprises in it, which were kind of cool. You know, the leads were good enough, but it was just one of those movies where I was watching it and I'm like, yeah, whatever. Like, I watched the whole thing, but then immediately after, I'm like, I didn't really need to spend time doing that.
I'm really hot or cold on the hunting human movies. I really am. Like, I feel like I should like them, but most of the time I just come away the way you're talking, where I'm like, is what it is. Like I love, you know, I love slasher movies.
Yeah.
But my least favorite type of slasher movies are forest slashers.
Yeah.
Like, apart from, like, you know, Mad Men or something like that, I just can't get into them as much. Like, the ones with, like the Final Terror or Don't Go in the Woods.
Yeah.
Those ones I just can't.
Yeah.
Like, with the crazy hillbilly, I don't know.
Well, the thing is, I mean, you know, I'm not going to say it's easy to make a, like, siege movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's a little easier to establish tension when you've got people trapped somewhere.
Right.
Okay. And, you know, any horror movie, like, it's not going to be effective if you can't get the tension. So when you're making like a siege movie, it's a lot easier, I would think, to be able to establish that tension where people are trapped, they can't get out, they don't know what they're going to do.
You can play on claustrophobia.
Exactly. When you're opening it up into a forest, you better be really good at tension and coming up with scenes that have that. Are you okay? Is that okay?
Yeah.
If you're going to do this. If not, it's just like people running around in the forest. And that's what this felt like. Like, I never really felt too worried. Like, even though some shit happens, I never, you know, I kind of figured out, like, in my brain, like, what, how it was going to kind of end up. In a loose sense, so I was never really felt that much threat for certain characters.
Well, yeah, you're super right, because we can go back to our underrated 70s episode in Rituals, which is a movie I picked, which is a forest one, and I just finished saying I don't really like forest ones, but the reason Rituals works is because it is tight like that, and it does have boundaries, even though you're in this big area where, you know, you're acres and acres of room. The movie has boundaries and establishes those boundaries so that you know it's just this one little chunk of the forest that the movie's going to kind of be staying in, and then you're not, you know, it's more focused, and it's not just going to be like, oh, we're walking through the woods. Oh, someone jumped out. Oh, we walked another 2 miles. Oh, someone jumped out.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And yeah, you're right.
And it's like, you know, there's a scene in this movie where one of the characters is climbing up a rock face. And I'm just like, okay, this should be way more intense.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't stop thinking of John Voight in Deliverance. And I'm like, this is not that at all.
Yeah.
But like, how is this not, why aren't I like at least kind of a little worried? Like I just felt like when that, in that scene in particular, you know, she doesn't know what she's doing. She's trying to climb up this rock face freehand. And I felt like I should be pretty stressed out, but I'm just like, I don't know, it's just going to take her a couple minutes to get up there.
she'll be fine.
Exactly.
She'll be fine.
So, you know, it had some interesting imagery. Like, I kind of liked the way that, you know, the bad people were on bikes and stuff. And I thought that was kind of unique. And their masks were kind of cool. But overall, yeah, I've already talked more about this than I wanted to.
So what's number two?
Number two is called The 33.
Okay, I know what this is.
Okay, so this is from 2015, directed by Patricia Riggen. And this is about the, now I love disaster movies, so this is about the Chilean mining disaster where a bunch of Chilean, 33 Chilean miners were mining away, and then there was a collapse or an explosion, and they got trapped in the mine, and they only, you know, they ended up getting into this kind of like, it's called what's called a safe zone. And but they were down there really far down, like way into the earth, and very, very limited supplies, and a very slim chance that they were going to get rescued. And it was just sort of so it was just the story of what do they do in this situation and how do they get out. Problem with this one is you already know they're going to get the fuck out because you know the story. So, you know, like the whole thing about this new story was how great it was that all these Chilean miners got out alive. So I liked the movie, but it was like kind of weird because I'm like, okay, well, I don't have to worry about any of these guys because nothing's going to happen to them because they're all going to get out at the end.
Yeah.
So I almost wish that they had just taken that idea. And I think there's other movies like this. Like, I know when I've been going through like Netflix, you know, there's like Mind Games and stuff like that. Like, there's other mind movies that are horror movies or survival movies in a similar situation.
Or kind of like The Descent.
Yeah. Yes. Kind of wish I had watched one of those because, yeah, really, I'm just sitting there like, okay, well, yeah, he's freaking out a bit. And, oh, yeah, they're running out of food, but they're all going to be fine. You know?
No tension here.
It was true. There was really no tension. Like, now, well performed. It's kind of cool that this got, you know, I do think it's important for important historical events to get, you know, put into a film. So it's kind of cool. But I did feel like this just could have been like a TV movie. Like it felt like one of those like two-parter TV movies from the 80s, you know, and it was good. I mean, Antonio Banderas was the star. I thought he was great. I think he's making some actually pretty good choices. I think he's actually got kind of a cool second career happening right now. And I know he's got some revenge movie out now, and yep, he's got a couple of cool movies and he's looking pretty badass. So
I'm kind isn't of into- he in that new Paul Solit movie, Bullethead, isn't he in that? Or is that,
oh, he no, might be, yeah.
I think Adrian Brody's in it, but I thought he might be in that too.
He's got a few movies out right now that look pretty cool. So I'm kind of into Antonio again, and he was good in this. Also had Rodrigo Santoro, Lou Diamond Phillips is in this. Again, he's another guy where I'm kind of like, he's kind of cool, like cooler than he used to be, you know, like Lou Diamond. I think he's been doing some neat stuff as well lately. Juliette Binoche, who, you know, I really loved her in The English Patient, and she's kind of popped up here and there, but it was kind of cool seeing her. James Brolin, haven't seen him in a movie in a long time, you know, Mr. The Car. And Gabriel Byrne, another guy I just haven't seen in fucking forever. And I used to love Gabriel Byrne. So yeah, it was a really good cast. It's just, and it was really well acted. And it was kind of neat to like learn a little more about these guys and get what they kind of went through to some degree. But yeah, I just never felt really that worried because I knew how it was going to end up. So that's The 33.
So I've confirmed that Antonio is in Bullethead.
Okay.
And just as a side note, if this was an 80s two-part movie, I think it'd be super fucking sweet if Ricardo Montalban was the main guy in the mine with them.
That would have been really cool.
Just saying.
Yeah, and it would have had young Lou Diamond Phillips in it.
That's true. That's true. He'd be like, I went from La Bamba to this TV miniseries.
Yeah.
How many you got left?
I got, well, I'm just going to do one more of the short Netflix one.
Okay.
The last one is called The Overnight. This is from 2015, directed by Patrick Bryce.
Oh, the guy who made Creep 1 and 2. Okay.
Now, I knew about this one a little bit because and a few years ago, I did listen to the Adam Carolla podcast from time to time, and I knew this was shot at Adam Carolla's house. It also stars, one of the stars is Jason Schwartzman, who I also is an actor I've liked in pretty much everything I've seen him in, even though I've never seen a Wes Anderson movie. also co-stars Aaron Adam Scott, who is also usually pretty reliable. Yeah. And Taylor Schilling from Orange is the New Black. Yeah. And the other actress was Judith Godrich. I don't know a lot about her. But this is it's just about Adam Scott and Schilling are husband and wife, and they've got a kid, and they've just moved to LA, and they're having trouble making friends. So they run into Jason Schwartzman at the park, and he's like kind of this hipster dude. So he invites them over for dinner. So then it's just them going over for dinner at Jason Schwartzman's house with his wife, and it's one of those like the night of movies where just they start drinking and they smoke a bit of pot, and then things just start getting weirder and weirder and weirder. And it's a really uncomfortable movie. It's a comedy, but it's got some moments that are just pretty uncomfortable. Like there's full frontal from Schwartzman and Scott, but they're both wearing prosthetic dicks. One massive and one tiny, which is pretty hilarious. And Schwartzman's character, like his hobby is he gets people to pose so he can paint giant paintings of their assholes so they look like flowers. So it's just like this weird humor throughout,
right?
But then it's also got kind of like relationship stuff going on. I thought it was really good. It was a pretty solid little fun movie, and a bit of a break for Patrick Bryce from the two Creep movies. It's a cool little mumblecore, I guess is what they're calling it, a little comedy that I thought was pretty enjoyable.
Makes sense, the sense of humor thing, because Creep and Creep 2 have similar kind of humor at times. So yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, it was a good one.
All right, so what do you...
And that's not coming off Netflix, so you can watch that if you want.
What do you have left for numbers here?
How many numbers? I've got 1, 2, 4.
Okay, I've got 4, so we'll just 1 and 1 it then.
Okay.
My next selection is going to be a quick one because you've talked about this in the past, and I'm talking about it now, and that's 1999's Lake Placid. So I figured let's keep this Steve Miner boat rolling after Big Bully. And... plus, I was like, oh, it's late at night. I need something to watch. I've got this closet full of movies that I've bought that I need to watch so I can dump them off at Josh's house. It's 82 minutes. Why the fuck not? Now, this is a movie written by David E. Kelley, who was coming off Ally McBeal at the time. He did write the Big Little Lies miniseries last year, which I really, really dug.
Yeah.
And this was his big, like, oh, David E. Kelley's making this monster movie. I remember at the time this was coming out, and they were so excited he was writing this monster movie. Well, stars Bridget Fonda, who I really like, who hasn't been in anything since, like, 2002.
Yep.
Bill Pullman's in this. You got Betty White being a foul-mouthed local, and I think this is kind of the movie that started her on that trend to being that cool old lady that everyone loves now.
Yeah.
And we've got Brendan Gleeson, who's a character actor who steals pretty much every scene he's in as the sheriff. I thought he was great in this. The story is just really a small town who's, beset by a giant crocodile, which might be prehistoric. Bridget Fonda sent in to investigate. Bill Pullman's also a scientist who's there. Oliver Platt shows up as this reality show kind of nature show host guy who kind of is comic relief but super annoying through most of the movie, and I didn't like the character.
No.
And you got Betty White telling someone to suck their dick, basically, you know, that kind of, yeah, that kind of stuff. So I found it to be pretty witty at first. Like, I thought some of the dialogue was pretty funny and stuff like that. I thought Brendan Gleeson was like killing it because he was like, he kept getting treated like he was a dumbass, even though he wasn't a dumbass, and he kept going with it. And I thought that was okay at first, but then it got tiresome. Like, it ran out of steam, especially when Oliver Platt's character was pushed to the forefront of the movie because he's fucking annoying.
Yeah.
Another thing, the special effects in this were kind of hit or miss.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there is practical, there is a little bit of CG, but like the whole movie itself, it's pretty hit or miss, the effects wise.
Yeah.
You know, there's not much else I can really say about this movie. I got to tell you, like, it's unfortunate because, like I said, I like most of the cast. Like, I like Bill Pullman generally.
What did you think of Pullman's performance in this?
I thought he was very, I thought he was kind of like zombie-ish. To be honest, this is not Bill Pullman at his best.
Like, what am I doing here?
Yeah, I thought Bridget Fonda was good.
Yeah, she
and
was.
I thought Gleason was good, but you know, Platt was fucking stinking up the place. I wanted to drown him or feed him to a fucking crocodile. And you know, Bill Pullman, like I said, he just kind of was like sleepwalked through.
Yeah,
not bad, not great. Kind of one of those middle, I have 82 minutes to kill before I'm going to bed kind of movies. Probably better than the sequels, I'm gonna guess.
Yeah,
I'm gonna guess. I don't know. There's four fucking sequels to this.
I've reviewed them all. I know, the show.
And there's a crossover with Anaconda.
I would say.
Have
two?
You watched the Anaconda one? I don't remember.
Yeah, I did watch the Anaconda.
Oh, okay.
Two is the one with John Schneider.
That one's
from
better.
Dukes of Hazzard was not bad, but the CG gets worse in the sequels.
Okay.
But the other comment I'll just make on this is, of all the Scream Factory releases I own, this is the only one I'm considering selling.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to mention is, and this is mildly spoilerish, the finale to this movie is fucking terrible. And if I ever in my lifetime have to see a fucking cow suspended from a helicopter being dipped in water and have Betty White's character said, or Bridget Fonda's character say, she looks like a tea bag, I will fucking kill myself. So that's Lake Placid.
Okay. Well, I like to watch. I'm trying really hard to get my girlfriend's son into horror.
Yes.
And it's not been easy.
Not like us who took to it like stink.
So he's 13 now. So yeah, we're getting to the age where I feel like I got to get this done.
Well, you do, because both of us got into it when we were like 9 or 10.
Yeah. So I decided, you know what?
I got to get this done. you sound like you'll be so fucking disappointed if it doesn't happen.
I won't. He's his own guy. He can do whatever the hell he wants.
Like, what the fuck do you mean you don't like Nightmare on Elm Street?
But it would be, I would like to look forward to the next few years.
All right.
Introducing him to, you know, all of the greats. All
right.
Because, you know, we're getting to the age where I could show him Creepshow, you know, but if he's not into horror, I got to get this done.
Right.
So I decided, you know what, I'm going to go back to the basics.
Okay.
So I went with Abbott and Costello Meets Frankenstein.
Okay, that's a good one.
And from 1948, directed by Charles Barton. I knew this was risky business because I'm going with a comedy.
And it's black and white.
In black and white. Yeah. That's got humor that might or might not work. That's kind of a bit scary. So, you know, I mean, it's got three of classic monsters in it. So I didn't know how this was going to go over. He really liked it.
Oh, that's good.
So I'm like, thank God.
That's good.
So actually, he was, if we didn't run out of time, I think he was down with watching Frankenstein next. So
if you're going to talk about horror comedies, which we know you don't like too much, I'm more of a fan of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein is tip top horror comedy.
Yeah. I forgot how good this was. Like, and I forgot, like, it's okay. Okay, let me just go over the plot a bit. So it's got Abbott and Costello. If you don't know who Abbott and Costello is, please just go Google Who's on First or something.
Or go buy the fucking Universal box set. that I got for Christmas because it's pretty rad.
Which one do you have?
I got the one that has all 48 of their Universal.
The DVD one?
Yeah, the DVD. That's it's not out on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I have that too.
Yeah.
And that's what I bought. There's a lot of repeats on that. It's the only thing I thought was a bit annoying about the box set. Like, Abbott and Costello Meets Frankenstein is on the Frankenstein one.
Well, yeah, that
and
one.
And the Dracula one and the Wolfman one.
No, I got the one that's actually just an Abbott and Costello specific
set,
okay, where it's all of their Universal.
Right, right.
Like, Buck Privates and, like, you know.
Abbott and Costello box set.
It's just their movies.
Okay, so the Universal's cashing in on that end, too.
Well, yeah, but that box set's worth it if you dig.
Yeah, they were fun. They were a fun comedy duo.
Yeah.
Back in the 30s and 40s, and this was as far as horror fans are concerned, their top movie. So it's got them. They're playing they work at a train station, and they get some mysterious parcels in. At the train station, they're supposed to be delivered to this house of horrors, but they get a phone call from Lawrence Talbot, played by Alon Chaney Jr., of course, is the Wolfman, telling them don't deliver these, or shit's gonna go down. So then, of course, they end up delivering them because it wouldn't be any fun if they didn't deliver them. And if they deliver them to this horror house, which is like a wax museum, and of course they break open the crates, and then Frankenstein and Dracula, come out of their crates and start terrorizing the duo. And then it just becomes a movie about, Abbott and Costello like running around and like trying to deke out the monsters. Meanwhile, Lon Chaney Jr. is trying to like stop this whole thing from happening. And then, eventually they get to Dracula's castle and, more hijinks ensue. It's pretty funny. I mean, I did think a bit of the humor, particularly with Costello, being, scared by Bela Lugosi popping out of the coffin and going back in and popping out and going back in. Like, I did feel like it got a little bit repetitive, like just a tiny little bit, but I certainly didn't think of that when I was like 12. So I loved it back then. And I still think it's a great movie. I was pretty surprised by how intricate the plot was. Like, there was a lot more going on that I remembered. It was a joy watching Lugosi in a kind of comedic role. I actually didn't realize that this is only the second time he'd played Dracula, and the second and last time he played Dracula. You know, he'd been a vampire in a whole bunch of movies, but he only played Dracula twice. Yeah. Chaney as the Wolfman always looks great. And Glenn Strange playing Frankenstein's monster was also great. He had been Frankenstein's monster in House of Dracula and House of Frankenstein, but of course it wasn't Boris Karloff, but I was okay with that. Super fun movie. A lot of surprising things happened. Like, there was a little more death than I remembered. It's a really fun movie, and you really understand why it's a classic and it still holds up big time.
I feel like this movie might be partial inspiration for Scooby-Doo.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
So
it's surprising how well it held up, and I was really surprised how much it was enjoyed by a young kid as well. Like, and really made me happy. Like, because I mean, I was thinking about it. I was talking to him about it. I'm like, I loved this when I was your age, and it was 30 years before I was born. So why wouldn't he, right? I mean, it's not like I'm trying to show him something from when I was his age that actually came out in the theater.
Right.
Like, it was still really old when I watched it too, right?
Well, it's just weird in this era of YouTube and stuff that's it's really good to hear that someone in that age range is enjoying this like super classic. And for me personally, you're right, this is the pinnacle of their monster crossovers.
Yeah,
because I really had a hard time with some of the other ones, like the one Abbott Costello Meet the Invisible Man. I was kind of cold on for the most part, and
right.
They had what's the other one,
they meet the killer, the one with Boris Karloff.
The killer, yeah. Boris Karloff, that one's okay, but
I think there's a mummy one as well.
Yeah, this is the one that if you want to watch their crossovers with the Universal Monsters, this is the one. And everybody acknowledges that this is the one.
And it's when they were top of their game. It's before they were really fighting and like they were really at the top. And the humor still works. And, aside from just a bit of repetition, Bud Abbott as a straight man is just totally perfect. And it's got to be a tough role, man, like just being always that guy and where Costello's getting all the
just
laughs.
Just kind of rolling your eyes at your sidekick yeah. all the time and shit.
But he was great. They were really a great duo and still are. So, yeah, Abbott and Costello meets Frankenstein.
Nice. Let's jump from that to a not-so-classic movie starring Steven Seagal, shall we? Let's talk about Steven Seagal's last theatrical release before he went to direct-to-DVD hell. Let's talk about a movie where Alcatraz gets reopened as a high-tech prison and a bunch of bad guys led by Morris Chestnut and Nia Peoples decide to break in because the guy on death row knows the location of $200 million in gold bars. Let's talk about a movie where Steven Seagal plays a Russian without an accent whatsoever, and when someone says to him, "You're Russian, aren't you?" And he's like, "You got a problem with that?" in his regular voice. Let's talk about a movie that has rappers Ja Rule and Corrupt co-starring in it. Let's talk about 2002's Half Past Dead.
Let's talk about how much I want to see this.
Okay, not the worst Seagal thing. Right off the bat, I'm going to say that. It's better than On Deadly Ground. It's better than Fire Down Below. And it's definitely better than any of the fucking garbage he's been putting out since 2002 when... You know, when he went direct to DVD.
Right.
It's a silly as shit movie because, first of all, it's fucking Alcatraz.
Yeah.
They've reopened it with all these, you know, high tech gadgets. You know, you've got Morris Chestnut being all suave and cool, busting in with his henchmen all dressed in like leather suits and machine guns. And then you've got like Seagal and all the rappers, you know, sneaking through the friggin' jail through Alcatraz, like avoiding them, but also beating the shit out of them from time to time. You got all this going on. You got silly stunts. You got friggin' ridiculous action scenes. You've got Nia Peoples from North Shore, is the movie I mm-hmm. mostly know her from, decked out in tight leather, kicking fucking ass. She's so good in this, dude. So good in this. And, you know, it's stupid. Let's just put it that way. It's stupid.
Yeah.
You know, it gets tiresome, admittedly, but you get to see a helicopter crash through the roof of Alcatraz, so that's okay.
Yeah. And they went through a lot of helicopters in that back in the day. Eh?
They did. And the problem is, the thing that makes this movie not work, admittedly, is the addition of the rappers.
Hmm.
Ja Rule cannot fucking act. All he does in this movie is smirk at people.
Right.
That's not acting. Corrupt, he's the comic relief. He's also in the sequel to this. Not that good. But Seagal has not gotten to the point where he's super fucking lazy yet.
Yeah.
So he does try a little bit. You can tell he's getting there where he's starting to get lazy, but at least he's sort of trying.
Yeah.
It's not all obvious stunt doubles this time out.
Right.
So... if you like Seagal movies or dumb action movies from this era, watch Half Past Dead. I didn't love it, but I also was like, hey, for a Seagal movie, this is actually watchable. And considering all I've been watching of his stuff is the direct-to-DVD stuff, I forgot that he actually did make some pretty watchable movies at once.
Yeah.
Like, this is not Under Siege. This is not Out for Justice or Hard to Kill. It's not quite as good as those, but it's okay. It's right. Like 90 minutes long. How can you go wrong? Worth noting, there was a sequel to this, direct to DVD, in 2007 without Seagal. They replaced Seagal with wrestler Bill Goldberg.
Really?
It's again a prison movie. Corrupt, I believe, plays the exact same character he played in this movie. Also, written and directed by Don Michael Paul, who is worth mentioning just because this is a guy who is, to this day, so fucking busy making direct-to-DVD sequels. This guy has made Lake Placid 4.
Mm-hmm.
This guy made Tremors 5 and 6. This guy made the latest Sniper movie. He's making the newest Death Race movie, Death Race 4 or whatever it is. He's making the new Scorpion King movie. So this is a guy who's busy making these movies, and for what they are, they're efficient.
Yeah.
Might not be the greatest, but at least they're efficient. So that's what you're getting from Half Past Dead. If you dig Seagal, check it out.
Nice.
You'll watch this shit, won't you?
Yes, I will.
Because it is in the other room.
I will watch it. I did notice that, yes.
Yes, okay.
Okay. All right.
A heavy sigh.
I don't really want to bring this one up, but I have to.
A heavy sigh.
This is a Vancouver shot movie.
Okay.
That was put out by SRS Cinema.
Okay.
It's called Teenage Slumber Party Massacre, or Nightmare, directed by Richard Mogg.
Okay.
So Richard Mogg is a Vancouver-based director that has had a few movies come out from SRS. I believe one's called Massage Parlor of Death. There's another one about Bigfoot Ate My Girlfriend or something like that. I know, Chris, you were talking to him at Cinemware,
yeah.
Cinema Fantastic 3. I think he might have something coming out.
Yeah, he's got a book called Analog Nightmares, which is about the 90s shot on video horror genre stuff. And we were thinking about talking to him about it, actually.
Yeah, it would be great. I'm hoping we can get him on the show at some point.
Yeah.
That being said, I did decide to want to check out one of his movies, and you know, I see what he was trying to do here. So this is obviously a throwback to, you know, the guy's a big fan of shot on video. So this is obviously what he's trying to do, is kind of recreate that experience. It's a slasher movie, obviously. So the movie is about three teenage girls who decide to have a slumber party. And then eventually they're being stalked throughout, and eventually they start getting attacked by this, crazy dude. We know who the killer is very early on in the movie. My thing with this one is that I just feel like, and I know what he was trying to do. He was trying to really like establish characters and all that, and really kind of make you like these girls. But the problem is that it just, we're it's a 75 minute movie, like, or maybe even a little less. And we have to learn, you know, we have to like, we're kind of forced to like these girls for like the first 70 minutes of this. Like, we only really get a payoff in the last few minutes. And the payoff to me just wasn't very good. Like, it just, the gore was really kind of half-assed. The action was really kind of half-assed. There was a lot of talking with these girls. You know, they're talking about boys, and they're talking, and they watch a porno, and they you know, they're drinking and eating hot dogs. And they're at the park, and they're talking about boys some more, and they're yelling penis, they're pianist. And, you know, it's entertaining enough, but, like, one of the girls I found super annoying. Now, I think that's intentional, but having to sit through this long with these people was just not for me. So I'm sure it's for someone, but it just didn't really work that much for me. The other problem is that you're making a movie called Teenage Slumber Party Nightmare. I'm expecting a little bit of nudity, like zero. And like, I just don't understand why that decision would be made. Unless there's just such a concern nowadays about political correctness and not wanting to offend anyone that you're going to just go down that way. Or maybe he's just really anti-nudity for some reason. Not sure. Hopefully we can talk to him about it, because I'd really like to know. So, just a little, you know, just disappointing. I just felt like, you know, I spent my money on this, you know, and I was kind of expecting a little more. I do feel like there's, you know, when you're making a movie, and, you know, he says on the commentary track that he spent $100 making this movie, if that tells you anything. Okay, and that's great. Like, I think it's really cool that someone can make a movie and, you know, it be a, you know, kind of a homage to what they love, and make it for $100. That's really awesome. I wish I had the balls to do that. You know, I mean, it's kind of inspiring in a way. But at the same time, I spent a quarter of that budget buying this fucking thing. So I kind of wish I had gotten more out of it. Because I just feel like you know, especially in the like gore scenes, like, you know, he was attacking people with a drill, like it's like Slumber Party Massacre 2. But, you know, in half the shots, there's no drill bit. And, like, you know, I think you could, you know, ha, 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 like, oh, you know, like, it's, there's no drill bit. Ha, ha, look at how cheap it is. At the same time, I think it's a real fine line between, like, that ha, ha irony and you just being incompetent. And, like, I just don't know, like, I don't know what it was. Like, it wasn't self-aware enough for me to know that he knew that that drill bit wasn't there. You know, I was actually questioning, like, did he catch that? Or was he just like, fuck it, I only have like 5 minutes to edit the scene. Who cares? And I just maybe wasn't in on the joke. So I do want to check out his other movies. I mean, this was pretty well shot for such a cheap movie. I do kind of hope that, and he did say like on some of the other ones, there is a little more exploitation stuff. That's kind of what we want in a movie like this. So I just think if you're going to dupe someone into buying this like me, you better kind of deliver, you know? And I just felt like this one didn't really. So that's all.
Okay.
So you can borrow it if you'd like.
Sure, why not?
Teenage Slumber Party Nightmare.
I'll check it out.
Chris is like, fuck, he's never going to be on the show now.
Way to go, Josh.
I hope he's got an open enough mind, though, that if he does hear this, that he'd be cool with it. You know, he's got to know what he's doing, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you're spending $100, so...
You're spending $100.
You got to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
My next selection was made for more than $100. It's a 2017 movie that I was kind of interested in seeing when it came out, but it was one of those ones that was put out by Fox Searchlight, and, you know, it opened in only a few theaters, and then it kind of disappeared. And I happened to get it from the library, and it's a movie called Patty Cakes from 2017. It's written and directed by Jeremy Jasper. He's a music video director by trade. This is his film debut. And it stars Danielle McDonald as a girl called Patty. She's kind of like this overweight girl who's like got a shitty home life, who has dreams to become a world-class rapper.
Hmm.
But she lives in New Jersey, which in the shithole part of New Jersey. And, you know, everyone tells her she's not going to amount to anything, but she still has this dream to become this famous rapper. And her mom is played by this actress called Bridget Everett, who's a Canadian actress who I've seen off and on. She's kind of like she's an alcoholic, basically a cougary type who's always going to the bars and doing the karaoke to terrible hair metal songs because she was in a hair metal band when she was younger, and trying to pick up men and stuff. And she's kind of an embarrassment to Patty, and she doesn't really understand why she has these dreams of becoming this rapper. And it's what it is. It's, I don't want to try and sell it that it's a drama, because it's not. It's totally just a quirky indie kind of comedy. You right. know, and the McDonald in this is really engaging. I really liked her in this. I haven't seen her in anything else, but she's like, you know, she's just one of those girls who's like, it's good because she doesn't have the body image problems and stuff that you would expect in these comedies like this to have. Like, ho ho, let's all laugh at the fat girl and stuff, right?
Right.
They don't do that in this movie. Like, she's just like, I'm driven. I'm going to get to my dream, and I'm going to drag all these people along with me if I have to.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of like that. Her grandmother, who's wheelchair bound, is played by Kathy Moriarty.
Okay.
Who, her film debut was playing Robert De Niro's wife in Raging Bull.
I went to her pizza restaurant in L.A.
Did you really?
Yeah, I actually seeked it out because I found out she had owned this
what's
pizza
place. What's it called?
Fuck, I can't remember.
Oh, but, really? But well, anyway, she plays the grandma.
Good pizza. Good pizza.
She plays the grandma in this, and she's fucking hilarious.
Right on.
Like, she's so good in this. Like, there's the scene where they get the grandma to take her to this cabin in the woods this eccentric kind of goth metal guy is living in, because she wants to collaborate with him. And the grandma's, like, just sarcastic all the time and, like, putting down the mom. And she's just really great. So it's an energetic movie. It's a silly movie. But it's also pretty funny at times. It's really good-natured. And like I said, this Danielle McDonald, she's really good in this. Like, I really enjoyed her in this. And this is my kind of thing. You know that.
Yeah.
These are the kind of movies that are in my wheelhouse. These kind of indie, quirky kind of comedies that people might not have heard of or whatever. If you're into movies like Little Miss Sunshine or Way Way Back, like the kind of stuff Fox Searchlight generally puts out, then you'll dig Patty Cakes, I think. I mean, it also helps that it's very kind of satirical about the music industry and about like the rap, like the whole rap scope, that if you want to see that kind of stuff, definitely check this out. I mean, I don't know if it's for everybody, but I thought it was a lot of fun.
Great.
So I'm sure it's not really your thing.
Probably not.
Probably not.
Maybe. You never know.
You never know.
Probably if I actually sat down and watched it, it'd be great. But just probably not something I'd go out of my way.
Yeah, I remember seeing the trailer for it and thinking it looked like it could be fun. So yeah. When I finally got a chance to track it down, I'm glad it actually paid off that I did enjoy it.
Yes, because instead of going for quality indie dramas, I end up going for shit like Bunny the Killer Thing.
What the fuck is this?
From 2015.
Is this the one that like came in like this hard box case and it looks kind of rapey bunny on the cover?
Yes,
like,
Chris.
Oh, fuck.
it was Easter. So I was like, oh, so let's you know celebrate. What? It's Easter.
I'm going to celebrate Easter by a fucking rapey bunny.
Well, yes.
You know how I celebrate Easter, Josh? I go on YouTube and watch the clip from Critters 2. That's how I celebrate Easter.
Well, I celebrated Easter by watching, yes, a Finnish horror movie about a bunny with a giant penis that he helicopters around often.
Fuck's sake.
So this is, from 2015, directed by Judas.
Helicopter dick.
And he yells, pussy, as he's helicoptering. And that's his only dialogue.
Does he yell pussy in Finnish, though?
No, he yells pussy in English.
Oh, okay.
So he goes, pussy, as he's helicoptering his dick, and then chases someone. And then
what
he
the
like
fuck is wrong with you?
He you know, like every yes he I guess
you're really knocking it out of the park with these last two selections.
I guess he kind of rapes, but it's no, I shouldn't be laughing at rape, but it's not even. It's more like I don't even know what it like. It's just he just like helicopters, yells pussy, runs, jumps on someone, then jumps up again, yells pussy, helicopters, and runs after someone else.
Speaking of helicopters, and
okay, I'll just read my notes. Bunny shouting pussy, helicoptering. That's exactly what I wrote down. Tension with criminals versus young people is poor. Okay, so. We've got some young people that decide to go to their cabin to go for a drinking weekend. One of them, for whatever reason, is wearing a respirator mask. Another one's kind of, you know, slutty. Another guy, one of the guys is like, you know, a real dick who's like trying to get with them all and is, you know, kind of one of those like thinks he's really hot but isn't really. And the other girl has kind of got an evil streak going through her. So they're at least they're kind of unique characters. But then they run into these three criminals that we find out later. I won't reveal what they're up to. But you can tell they're up to something, and they're kind of badass criminals. So they end up breaking down on the side of the road and then meeting our, you know, young people on their way to the cabin. And then the young people decide to bring these people to the cabin with them. They don't know they're criminals, but still, I wouldn't bring three strangers to a cabin when I was trying to get with some chicks. Like, that just doesn't even make any sense. Anyway, they go to the cabin, and, you know, these guys are bad people. So, like, I'm kind of expecting some tension there. No, there's a little tiny bit, but there should have been a lot more. Okay, what's my next line? Looks good, but repetitive and a bit boring. Yeah, I know. It seems like the theme tonight. Weird female date rape scene. Oh, yes. There was this weird female date rape scene. Okay.
okay.
No, it was weird. There was this, like, so it's got this, like, this young Finnish boy. He's in a closet, and he's kind of, like, looking out at this girl who's, like, passed out on the bed. And then this other woman, the kind of evil chick, comes in and, like, yeah, like, literally starts making out with this girl who's passed out on the bed. And it was just super random and bizarre. Like, it didn't make any sense. There was no need for it. And I don't know if they were just trying to be kind of offensive, but it wasn't even really that offensive other than that it was, well, it was date rape, of course, so it was kind of offensive. But, I mean, it didn't really feel like it was just really out of place.
It'd be different if the bunny was in the closet helicoptering, yelling pussy while this was going
on.
No,
the bunny was outside helicoptering and chasing people in the snow.
Pussy!
A lot. So there's the evil girl, there's the respirator mask, there's the hero girl. There's lots of death scenes.
What's your next note?
Thought it would be more gore and nudity. Yeah, because the one I bought was like a, it said like limited, you know, XXX version. So I thought it was going to be, I thought this movie was going to be really over the top. Now, I mean, of course it's fucking over the top. We got a helicoptering bunny yelling pussy all the time and jumping on people and fucking eye sockets and stuff like that. So of course it was over the top, but it wasn't nearly what I was expecting. I thought this was going to be like crazy over the top, like nudity everywhere and gore everywhere and like blood flying. And there was a lot of blood flying. There were some good gags. But it just felt, I don't know how, but it felt kind of dull. And I don't really understand how, given what I've just described. But it was just felt like, again, back to way back to the beginning of this episode, a long time ago, when we were talking about preservation, like, I just didn't feel much tension. I was just like, oh, yeah, there's all these people. I couldn't really give a flying fuck about many of them. Oh, that person died. Oh, that person died. Oh, that person's being chased. I don't really care if they die. You know, and, you know, there are a few good gags, but I never really cared. I was just like, oh, it's kind of funny. And, you know, Helicopter Dick Bunny was pretty funny to a degree. But I just thought this would be a little more. I was expecting more like Dead Alive or something, like just really over the top. And it had all the elements, but it just felt like it wasn't quite there.
It kind of sounds like a movie I remember watching. I think it's from 2008 or 2009, called Attack of the Cockface Killer.
I remember that one. Yeah. I see that one too.
Kind of reminds me of that, where it's like. A guy running around in a helmet with like a dildo strapped to his chin, killing people.
Yeah,
like that seems to be like what this movie should have tried to go for. Because that movie, I remember going full bore, trying to be offensive and gory.
Yeah, I remember that one.
I remember
too.
Someone getting like a broomstick shoved up their ass or something. Yeah. There was all like that's what this movie should have maybe attained to and hit that niche market, because there are those fucking weirdos out there who like these kind of things. Josh bought it.
Well, you're a trauma fan. Don't put
I know
it on
I
me.
Am,
I mean,
I am.
You like this shit.
I know, but I'm just saying
it should have gone more trauma.
Yeah,
is
yeah.
what I'm saying. Like it should have like trauma.
Well, especially with the artwork I've seen and everything.
Yeah, and like when you look at like Poltergeist or something, like the trauma is really going over the top now. And I was expecting that. I was expecting this just to be, you know, crazy, like wall to wall, like Nukem High, the one that we saw last year,
right.
Or even like Pool Party Massacre. Like I just thought it was going to be like really kind of nutty, and it wasn't. It just felt like something was missing, and there was a lot of, you know, had really good production value. Like I said, the gore gags were really good. There was like some CGI backgrounds and stuff that looked really good. I won't say the bunny suit looked really good, but the cock flying around was pretty funny. And I just expected more, and I'm kind of like, really? Did I bought a 3-disc version of this shit? Like why? But anyway, it has a cool cover. Bunny the Killer thing.
All right. You have one left?
I have one left.
Okay, so this is my last selection. This is a movie that, well, I'm going to say now on April, whatever this is, April 9th, I'm going to say this is a movie that will likely end up on my top five of 2018. This is a movie I went and saw in the theater.
The theater.
And this is a movie called A Quiet Place.
Right.
Written.
No spoilers, please.
No. Co-written, directed, and starring John Krasinski, who most of us will know as playing Jim from the sitcom The Office with Steve Carell and Rainn Wilson. I don't know what it is lately with people who are known for comedy just fucking killing it in the horror genre. Because last year it was Jordan Peele with Get Out.
Yeah.
And now it's... you know, John Krasinski with A Quiet Place. I feel like that I have good hope for the Halloween that comes out this year, because that's being made by people who are known for comedy. You never know. I'm not going to spoil anything. I'll just go over the basic of the plot. It's a post-apocalyptic movie, for starters. It's set in a world where, you know, there's monsters roaming the landscape who are attracted to sound.
Okay.
So the movie just follows Krasinski, his wife, Emily Blunt, and children who have to eke out an existence in this world with these monsters, where they have to try and stay as quiet as possible and not draw these monsters to them.
Okay.
Which obviously doesn't work all the time.
Yeah.
So that's all I'm going to say about the plot.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you that this is a movie that I went into thinking, you know, I should like this. When it was over, I was just like, I really liked this.
Okay.
So the reason this works for me is that this is a movie that you actually care.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's done such a good job establishing the family that you actually care about the family before anything bad even starts to happen. So that's a plus. Because the thing I always try and tell, always try and say about horror movies is that you need characterization. Mm. And if you don't have characterization, your movie is not going to be as effective. This movie is a big statement for that, saying if you have characters in the genre, in a genre movie like this, that you actually give a shit about, then you're going to give a shit about the movie more.
Yeah.
And I've always said that. And I feel like a lot of horror filmmakers just seem to be missing that. They just want to get in there, do their scares, do their gags, and get it done.
Yeah.
Whereas if you take that little bit of extra time and do that, like add that characterization, you're going to get something like this. This is only a 95-minute movie. But you know, before this movie's even halfway through, I know these characters. I know their personality traits. I know how they're going to react to situations and things like that. That's something that I think in genre movies is very important. And it's very important for me personally now, being, you know, in my 40s. Mm-hmm. I'm not a fucking 13-year-old watching a horror movie and just being like, oh, someone got their head chopped off. Oh, this is happening. This is that's the reason I've kind of avoided watching horror movies a little bit more than I used to, because it is the same fucking shit recycled a lot of times. Mm-hmm. I love the horror genre. It's always going to be my first love. Don't get me wrong. But I need movies like this to come along to reestablish with me why I watch these movies sometimes.
Right.
And that's what this does. It's building up its tension early, you know, with all the silence and all the near miss stuff and everything. It builds that up really well. And I got to tell you, dude, the last half of this movie, I've not been on edge like I was in the last half of this movie in a theater for a long time.
Oh, good.
The last time I remember being a little bit more on edge was when I went and saw Green Room about 3 years ago.
Right.
That was similar experience where I was on edge through the last half of the movie.
Yeah.
This is even more intense than that.
Oh, cool.
It's just a really tense movie. It builds the dread. Through the whole movie, you're like, something is going to happen. I love horror movies where you're like, early on, you're like, something's going to happen. And you're just waiting and waiting for something to happen. And that's what this movie does really good. I'm not going to talk anymore about the plot. I'm done talking about plot. Emily Blunt, the co-star, is John Krasinski's wife in real life.
Yeah.
I've seen an interview with him where he's like, I wanted her to star in it in the first place. And, you know, and they're like, well, what if she decided not to star in it with you? He's like, well, then it'd be a little awkward at home, but we'd get over it. She's a good actress. I really like her.
Hmm.
She's good in this. Krasinski, who I'm used to just looking at a camera and smirking like he does in The Office, I've never seen him really stretch like this. He's really good in this. The kids are really good in this.
Right.
So solid acting, good effects, and like I said, tension. That's the thing that matters. And caring about customers. Or not customers. Caring about characters.
Right.
You know, it's not too often in a horror movie where I have an emotional punch, and this movie delivers that to me.
Great.
And that's why I love it. So if you want to experience this movie, you've said this before, and this is one I'm going to agree with you on this. Like you said about Dunkirk last year, this is a movie to experience in a theater.
Yeah.
The reason for that is, if you're used to going into a movie theater where everyone is noisy or whatever, this movie is generally silenced for the first 30 minutes. And when I was sitting in the theater, I'm like, wow, people are actually making an effort not to be too noisy when they're watching this.
Yeah.
And that's really different from what I'm used to hearing in theater. So it's kind of like an experiment in a way. Because he's probably like, let's see if I can make these motherfuckers be quiet for the first half an hour. So if you're digging on horror movies like, you know, The Descent, Get Out, you know, things that actually have something to say in the genre, go see A Quiet Place for sure.
Cool.
This is a movie that I can almost guarantee you is going to be on my top five of the year.
Nice.
Are you interested in this one?
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't sure because I haven't heard you talk about it. You should go check it out, dude.
Yeah, I'll go see it.
All right.
I might go this weekend.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And then you can tell us how you what you felt about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, cool.
Josh's VHS Adventures! Yep.
Yep. Every time I do it now, you're just like, yeah.
No,
yeah.
No. I've been, you know,
one more thing about A Quiet Place I just want to mention. I just thought of it. Killer pre-title sequence.
Nice.
That's all I'm saying. As you were.
All right. So I'm... I don't know if I should just, like, start watching, like, the most crazy shit I can find. Because that's what I feel like I should do sometimes.
Okay.
But I'm just kind of going through the stuff that's in my house. Anyway, this was okay. This is a movie.
God, you're fucking selling the shit out of this.
No, it was actually pretty good. Okay. It's a movie starring Mark Dacascos.
Okay.
Do you know who he is?
Yeah. Is it Drive?
No, it's not Drive.
Oh, that's supposed to be his best one.
This was his, like, breakthrough movie. So Mark Dacascos...
Hang on, I'm trying
Mark Dacascos was, like, a martial artist who, like, you know, was sort of, you know, in the early 90s, was sort of rising up. It's like, you know, he was going to be, like, the next Van Damme, like, that kind of thing. And he never really got there.
Like, no, because he made a movie like DNA.
Yeah, he made. I remember when he was in Brotherhood of the Wolf.
Yeah,
I had really high hopes for that movie. I was really excited because it was this guy and Vincent Cassel, who I also really love, and I thought that movie was just going to fucking kill it. And I didn't really like it. And that's another one I actually should revisit.
But, yeah, I have that at home. I've never seen it.
But this is a movie called Only the Strong.
Oh yes, okay, okay, oh, I've seen it.
Okay.
I'm fairly disappointed.
Yeah. So directed by Sheldon Lettich. He did some Van Damme movies, most notably Lionheart and Double Impact.
Yep.
Okay, my tapes. This is one of the fun parts of VHS. The tape actually opened with a rap video of the theme song of the movie.
How's it go?
I don't remember.
Only the strong. Only the strong.
I don't know if they were doing the part, but...
Well, that's like my beatbox.
Yeah, and it was... but the disappointing part with the video before the movie is that, of course, the video is showing all the scenes
from the
movie.
So it's all spoilers.
Yeah, so, but I didn't really have any context. But, okay. So, Dacascos is in... he's a war veteran, I guess probably... This is probably like Desert Storm or something. And he goes back to...
Yeah, he would have been, because I think this movie's 93.
Yeah.
So yeah, Desert Storm.
93. So he goes back to his old hood and, you know, goes back to his old high school. And he runs into his old teacher, Jeffrey Lewis. Jeffrey Lewis was in a bunch of Eastwood movies. You've heard me talk about him before. He was in Eye of the Jury.
Great character actor.
But, you know, as soon as I saw him, like, you know, in his classroom trying to teach in this kind of, like, urban school setting, all I could think of was Roddy McDowall in Class of 1984.
Or
like,
you were thinking... As I walk through the valley, you were thinking of Coolio, weren't you? Oh, Dangerous Minds.
I haven't seen Dangerous Minds.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so what it is you know, it's one of these schools where, you know, all the kids are bad and, you know, they can't be taught anymore because they're just horsing around all the
Freckles
time.
Freckles shows up with a baseball bat and straightens that shit out.
Yeah, exactly. There's fights in the schoolyard all the time. It's a rough place. So Dacascos, you know, kind of kicks the shit out of a student really early. And
so is he a teacher?
No, he's just visiting Jeffrey Lewis.
Okay.
And then he kicks the shit out of this. I think it was a student. It was either a student or it was like a gang member that happened to be...
Who hangs out at the school selling drugs.
Real ugly motherfucker, too. I'm sorry, dude. Like Jeffrey Anderson Gunton, or I think that's his name. Jeffrey Anderson Gunton. Yeah, he was a really weird looking dude. Like, he had this really weird looking face. Jamaican dude. Anyway, Dacascos gets in a fight with him and then somehow gets a gig where he's able to, like, start teaching the bad, like, the worst of the worst kids. They get sent to a class with Dacascos kind of as an after school, like, almost like a punishment. But, like, he's going to teach them, like, kind of how to fight this new style of fighting called Capoeira. It's a Brazilian style of fighting that kind of it incorporates dance into it, and I thought this looks fucking ridiculous, and it does. Like when he's like, because he does this thing where he's like kind of bobbing back and forth while he's like crouched over with his ass out, and I was like, oh man, this does not look threatening at all. This looks really kind of awkward. And then all the kids,
what's gonna do with all that junk? Oh,
exactly. Then all the kids start doing it, and I'm just like, oh, this is fucked up. But you know, it does. It actually does turn out to be pretty interesting fighting style. And actually, of course, being me, I Googled like a bunch of Caporio videos, and I found like UFC videos of this style and stuff. But it's a lot of like flipping and stuff, like not like flipping like fucking Gymkata, but like doing little like hand flips and stuff.
I think there's a guy in Van Damme's Bloodsport who does that style of fighting. I think so.
It's really interesting. It's a really, you know, once he kind of get past the initial ass out bobbing thing, it's actually a pretty cool fighting style and really acrobatic.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is in Bloodsport because the guy is a black guy, and I think he's Brazilian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. So
I know what style you're talking about now.
Yeah. So he's trying to teach these kids this style. And, you know, they all start kind of getting into it, and they start getting along, and his program's really successful. But, of course, like the kind of like worst kid of them all, like the really bad one, that if, you know, of course starts to come around, his brother or his cousin or something is like the big kingpin of the neighborhood. And, you know, DeCosco's kid keeps getting into run-ins with him. And then it just turns into the typical, like, you know, DeCosco's versus the kingpin guy. But with that whole, like, yeah, like that dangerous minds, you know, kind of inspirational.
Lean on me.
Yeah, yeah. It had what's that? The Lou Diamond Phillips one.
Stand and deliver.
Like, it was like one
I've
of those.
I've never seen that one.
That's a good one. You've never seen that one?
No.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And The Principal with friggin' Lou Gossett.
Not The Principal. No, it's kind of, well, I guess.
That's not inspirational. That's just an action movie.
It's kind of like those inspirational ones mixed with.
The Principal.
And
The Substitute.
Yeah. I'd say more.
I'm reaching here, Josh.
It's more like that, the urban action, like than that. It's more I guess kind of like The Principal, but I'm more thinking like a cross between like, it would be like Stand and Deliver and Lean on Me if there were like fucking fight scenes with them, which there could have been, right? Like, but with big elaborate martial arts fight scenes. So it was kind of cool because
Stand and Deliver meets Karate Kid.
Yeah, yeah. So I actually quite enjoyed this one. It wasn't great, but I, you know, DeCosco's was really quite likable. I thought he played the part really well. A lot of the kids were pretty good. A few of them, you know, I've seen in like American Me and movies like that. One of them was actually the lead in Children of the Corn 2, Ryan Bollman.
I didn't mind him in Children of the Corn 2 either.
Do you know? Yeah, he was probably the lead kid, I would say. Yeah. Stacy Travis from Hardware is the love interest. I thought it was pretty fun, but nothing like crazy to write home about. I don't think I'm going to like run out and try and find the Blu-ray or anything like that, but it was certainly an entertaining enough watch. I do not really understand why DeCosco's didn't become bigger than he did. He was definitely direct to video, and I don't think a lot of people really know who he is. Like, he never achieved the Van Damme or even like a Scott Adkins status. But he's pretty good.
I heard his. I heard the one movie of his to see, if you want to see his movies, is a 1997 movie called Drive.
Okay.
I've heard that's like pretty rad.
Oh, really? Eh?
Yeah, I've heard the fight scenes in that are pretty great.
Yeah. Let me put it this way. I mean, this movie was enough to make me want to seek out more of his stuff.
Well, you should seek out Drive.
Yeah, I think I will.
I think it's only on VHS, too. So maybe another VHS adventure.
Wonder if I have it in a box somewhere. All right, that's it for that.
Josh's VHS Adventures!
All right, so that's it. Told you guys. I told you there was a lot of fucking movies that we were going to talk about. So get ready for us to count down 5 movies that we, have changed our minds on. So like I said, this was inspired by me revisiting Throw Mama from a Train. I did try and keep it on the positive side.
Yeah.
Like I said, I did not mention the worst offender for myself of a movie that I hated and has now become my favorite horror movie of all time. And that's Texas Chainsaw, because I absolutely despised that the first time I saw it. But the reasoning behind that is something that Josh and I have talked about in the past. Time, place, format.
Yeah.
Very important. If you're watching a movie with the wrong people, if you're in the wrong mood, if you're watching a shitty fucking dub VHS tape or something, that's going to affect your opinions. So taking that into account, I did try and avoid those situations as well when I was making mine. So, you know, Texas Chainsaw, I can tell you for a fact, the first time I saw it with my friend, his little sister, on a really grainy, washed out VHS tape, and we were distracted for a good chunk of it, and that's why I probably hated it. Now my favorite horror movie of all time.
Yeah.
So that I kind of avoided. I don't know what your parameters were. Kind of similar.
I didn't really avoid anything though.
Okay. Well, that's the only movie that I didn't write that's my worst offender, and I just didn't want to put it on.
Yeah.
Cuz I think I've talked about that in the past anyway.
Yeah.
So, I didn't really number mine this time, surprisingly.
And I actually realized I did write down another one, so I've only got one negative as well.
Oh, okay. Perfect. Should we start with our negatives then and get them out of the way?
Sure.
Okay. I'll start with my negative. And this is a movie that has a lot of love. It's a movie I did enjoy as a kid because I was 10 when it came out. It is a movie that is produced by Steven Spielberg. It is a movie that is directed by Richard Donner, who has made some amazing films in the past. We're talking Superman. We're talking The Omen. We're talking Lethal Weapon. This is a movie that I absolutely fucking despise now. And that movie is called The Goonies.
Despise?
I despise The Goonies.
Why?
Dude. Why? It's obnoxious.
Got Throw Mama from the Train in it.
It's obnoxious, dude. This is the thing. When I was a kid, I loved Goonies. It was like, this is an Indiana Jones movie for me.
Yeah.
You know, that's basically what it was. And I'm like, you got Sean Astin in this. You got Josh Brolin. You got Corey Feldman. And you've got Cary Grant as one of the female leads. Now, Cary Grant, I had a massive crush on. In the mid-80s, because she was in, like, Lucas as the love interest. Yeah. She was in this. She had that flaming red curly hair, and I was like, yeah, I like Cary Grant. It's also, when you look at the bad guys in this movie, as the adult me, I should fucking love this movie, because you got Robert Davi.
Yeah.
Joey Pants.
Yeah.
Joey Pants Leon. I'll just, for those who don't know, Joey Pants is a nickname. And Anne Ramsey from Throw Mama from the Train is the main matriarch of the bad guys. It's got pirate adventure. It's got gadgets. This is a movie that I loved as a kid.
It's got Short Round.
And it's got Short Round. No time for love, Dr. Jones. But I just cannot watch this movie anymore. No. I tried, and it grated my nerves. The kids just spend the whole fucking movie yelling at each other at the top of their lungs. They're just obnoxious and annoying, and I just can't stand it.
I'm with you, man. I mean, the difference is, because this one crossed my mind too, I've never liked it.
Yeah.
Like, I just never liked it.
See, ever. I did.
Yeah, and but I have watched it in the last 10 years, and I do know people still, there's a lot of love for this movie.
Well, there is. There's t-shirts you can buy. Yeah. I went down to Cannon Beach in Oregon where they filmed most of this movie, and there's a dock overlooking the water that has Goonies Forever carved into it, and all these people who went there specifically because Goonies was shot there.
Did they write that? Who wrote that?
Like, people who went there to see the filming locations carved their names saying Goonies and all this stuff. Like, just tourists.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't get it.
Yeah, it's...
I mean, if I'm going to watch a Richard Donner movie, I'm going to watch those three that I mentioned before.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on this.
I watched Lethal Weapon 4 before I watched The Goonies, and I don't Lethal Weapon 4.
That is a bold statement.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's my negative.
It's funny, too, because it's another one that is mildly gateway horror that I thought... Like, very mildly, but there's still, like, caves and
There's sloths. The pirate skeletons and stuff.
Yeah, but I can't bring myself to expose anyone to this.
No, but by all rights, judging by my taste, I should kind of like this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Robert Davi.
Yeah.
You know, I love Joey Pants.
Yeah.
I should like it, but I just can't. Yeah. I do not like Goonies.
No, I am with you. Totally.
What's your negative?
My negative, I mean, listeners of this show should already know this one, because it was, actually might not, it was very, very early on.
Well, then maybe they should go back and listen to that episode.
Like episode 2.
They should maybe tell people to listen to that episode with them.
Maybe not.
Oh, well, yeah, we were a little bit rough still back in episode 2.
Yeah, but it's Street Trash. And yes. That is a movie that I know Chris and I both really loved when we were young. And I think most people of my generation, horror fans,
yeah,
that were getting into gore and especially like indie horror movies and, you know, sort of trying to like get to that next level of like gore and like extreme and all that. We all used to love this movie, and yeah, it just does not work for me at all anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it definitely, like, in the viewing situation where we watched this, it was not a good scene.
Nope.
But even still, I was, you know, I was bored. I was just kind of waiting for things to happen. It's got a few good gags. I mean, I still like the Technicolor melts and stuff. Like, that's really cool. But, I mean, no character in this is likable, and, I just really don't understand why I used to think this was the shit, because it is the shit. To be honest, it just doesn't work anymore for me.
Well, the thing is, too, is like we had recorded the episode about Street Trash where we trashed it. Ha ha. And, you know, you're right. The situation we did watch it in was not productive to, you know, trying to introduce someone to this movie, and the people you're introducing to this movie are probably not the audience for this movie.
Yeah.
So that didn't really help matters, but I did try and watch this again after that situation, and I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And that was by myself in a decent mood, being like, I'm going to give Street Trash a chance. Maybe it was just, you know, time, place, situation. And so I popped in the Blu-ray, couldn't do it, ended up selling my Blu-ray couple days later.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This is a movie that has that cult following that I don't get it. I mean,
and most movies like this I still like most movies
I love
like
Dead Alive
this,
still,
yeah, like know? I still enjoy them, and even though I'm like older now,
yeah,
but like this, you know, these are all movies that we discovered in our, you know, late teens or 20s, and you know, a lot of them, you know, do like lose their luster as you get a bit older, but I just, you know, a lot of them I can still appreciate why I like them. This one I really had a hard time with. Like, I'm just like, the biggest culprit with it was boredom. Like, I was just like, it just felt like it was fucking taking forever to get to the next melt. And, you know, I just didn't like Mike, like the lead character.
Wait, like, and then like all the random like stuff that they're trying to offend with in the middle of the movie, like let's play tag with a cut off dick, like keep away, like hot potato with severed penis. And
yeah,
you know, just stuff like that. And just the whole rapey attitude of the movie in general, right?
Yeah.
It just doesn't fly anymore for me personally. It's,
yeah,
you know, and you're right. Maybe it's because in the 80s, we were just getting into the practical effects. We were getting into the gore gags.
Yeah.
And this one was one that was promising to deliver these crazy over the top gore gags.
And when they happened. But
this was like a kind of like a trauma movie too.
Yeah.
You know, and you're right. I'm with you.
Yeah,
I can't do it either.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, two negatives.
Okay, let's get out of the negative.
Let's get out of the negative and get in the positive. And I have a feeling that my list is going to be a little shocking, because even when I was thinking about it, I was shocked at myself.
Okay.
So, my number 4 is one of the biggest science fiction action movies of the 90s. It's a movie called The Matrix from 1999, directed by the Wachowskis.
Yeah.
And starring Keanu Reeves, Lawrence Fishburne.
I like how you're just like, the Wachowskis.
The Wachowskis. Well, that's all I'm going to... Why? What's wrong with that?
Because it used to be the Wachowski brothers.
Well, they're not the Wachowski brothers anymore.
So are they the Wachowski sisters, or are they just the Wachowskis?
I guess they could technically be the Wachowski sisters.
Yeah.
But I'll just call them Wachowskis.
Yeah, the Wachowskis. Well,
don't make this complicated, Josh. But anyway, this is a movie starring Keanu Reeves, Lawrence Fishburne, and what's her name?
Carrie Ann Moss.
Carrie Ann Moss. And Hugo Weaving.
yeah,
killing it as Agent Smith. But this is a movie where it was a phenomenon. You know, it came out. It became a big hit. It introduced bullet time, which fucking movies massacred and used way too much since. Fucking Wonder Woman used it for sure last year, even.
Yes.
Badly. But, you know, this is a movie that didn't do it for me the first time I watched it. I found it confusing. I found it, like, chaotic. I didn't understand what was going on. I have a hard time with sci-fi in general.
Yeah.
I find a lot of the sci-fi stuff I have to rewatch anyway. Like a movie like Dark City,
yeah,
from 1998, I had to watch that twice before I really got it. Granted, with Dark City, I did like it the first time I watched it.
Yeah.
So that's why it's not on this list. But the second time I watched it, like, okay, this is starting to make sense. Same thing with Blade Runner. I had to watch it,
yeah,
a couple times before it started clicking with me plot-wise. And I think that's what happened with The Matrix for me. First time I watched it, I didn't like it at all. I was just like, I don't understand why. Because I saw it on DVD the first time I saw it. Mm. So it had already been a phenomenon in the theaters and so on and so forth. I'm like, I don't get it. I don't get why people love this. Sure, some of the action scenes are kind of neat. The story's making no sense to me, so on and so forth. So about maybe six months after, or maybe a year or so after I had watched it, I was like, you know what? The sequels are coming out. Let's give this movie another shot. Put it back in, and I absolutely love The Matrix.
Yeah.
Like, The Matrix is one of my favorite sci-fi movies of all time. Still, oh, wow. Even though it's been exploited and made fun of and blah, blah, blah to this day, it's still one of my top 10 sci-fi movies, probably, of all time. You know, at the time, this was cutting edge.
Yeah.
And you can see that now just by looking at all the cloning and everything that's happened since. If something is cutting edge, usually it gets ripped off numerous times.
Yeah.
That's why we saw all the Pulp Fiction Tarantino ripoffs in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
Because Pulp Fiction was cutting edge. So there's that. This is the first time we ever kind of thought Keanu Reeves was cool. And I know he's having a resurgence of that coolness with John Wick and stuff like that. But, you know, up to the point that The Matrix came out, he was kind of just like that goofy guy who said, whoa, a lot, yeah, in movies, right? And in this one, he was just kind of badass and just kicked ass through the whole thing.
Yeah.
Lawrence Fishburne, I've always liked. He's steady in this as Morpheus. And, you know, it's just a movie that I was like, it's a universe that took a while to get into. And granted, the sequels didn't really work, especially the third one. Let's forget that fucking movie exists.
Yeah, I never even saw it.
Pretty terrible. But yeah, I really have come around on this one. And like I said, top 10 sci-fi now. And I didn't like it the first time I saw it.
Huh.
What do you think about me?
No, I liked it quite a bit, and I still do. Yeah, it's
pretty, yeah, so good. You liked it right away.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, like, that's the thing. It's like with sci-fi, I have those issues where if it's trying to build an elaborate universe,
yeah,
I have to watch something more than once.
Right. Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Yeah, so Matrix, that's my next choice.
Nice.
What do you got?
I've talked about this one lots on the show, but it was the first one that came to mind with this topic, so I will just bring it up, and that's Eaten Alive. By Tobe Hooper.
Okay. You have talked
from
about
1976. It was just so striking, the amount like that my mind changed on this movie, because I used to hate this movie, and I think a lot of it is the transfer. I mean, I think the new transfer from Arrow. Is it Arrow?
Yeah, Arrow.
Yeah. I think Synapse did it as well, didn't they?
No. Dark Sky put it out on DVD.
Dark Sky, yeah.
Yeah.
The release from Arrow is the one that really made me appreciate, yeah, this movie. And I just think I didn't know what was going on. And, you know, I think there's a lot of movies like this where back in the day, you know, a lot of the kind of like weird humor escapes us. Or, and I think it might escape some people always. Like, but I've really learned to appreciate weird in movies, and I love like strange characters. That's why I was saying about This Must Be the Place. That's why that seems like the kind of movie that eventually I'm gonna like, because it's just so full of weird. But it was just that first time through was just like a bit of an assault almost. Whereas, and this is kind of the same thing, like I was expecting like Texas Chainsaw 2, and I was expecting it to just be like, you know, this like crazy horror movie, you know, with an alligator in it. But instead, it's like just like all these like really odd characters like converging on this like hotel of this really odd character who happens to feed people to his pet alligator in the back. And but everyone in this movie is just so bizarro, like from the like, you know, the daughter of Mel Ferrer, who decides to just take her clothes off in a really, really slow, protracted shot for no reason, to Robert Englund being like super pervy and talking about his talking about how he's buck and he likes to fuck.
Yeah.
The Phantom of the Paradise guy, William Finley, like just having the most bizarre like husband and wife scenes with Marilyn Burns. Like I don't even recall the last performance I've seen like this. Neville Brand is the proprietor, like probably drunk through most of this and just in this totally unhinged, bizarre performance that you don't really understand what he's doing. But I just find like that all of this kind of worked somehow. And the fact that he shot this like backwoods, like bayou hotel set on a soundstage, and it looks like super weird because of that, like the way it's lit, like the like you can tell it's on a soundstage, yet it doesn't feel like it's on a, it's just, I can't even describe it. So there's just so much interesting weirdness going on with this movie that I've really learned to appreciate it. And it's one of these movies where every time I watch it, I'm kind of enjoying it a little more. And I used to hate this movie. I was so disappointed after Texas Chainsaw Massacre seeing this one. But I've really turned around on this one.
I think you just nailed it there by saying after Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Yeah. I think that's why a lot of people kind of dismiss this, because they were expecting another Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and this is not a bit like that.
Now, it does feel like a step backwards, and I have said that before. Like,
yeah,
it is a weird, it's again weird. I keep using that word with this movie, but it does feel like it's his after Texas Chainsaw movie that feels like the movie he shot before Texas Chainsaw. But it's all part of the strange charm of this movie. It's really worth checking out again. If you watch, particularly if you saw this on VHS and you haven't seen it since, I'd recommend a rewatch, because it's a totally different experience now. And yeah, maybe I'll get something out of it, maybe I'll not. But I've definitely, like, I actually kind of look forward to watching it again, and I don't even know why. So
yeah, I haven't seen it in a while. I have the recalled Dark Sky DVD at home. So I should really get around to rewatching it, because you've talked about it a lot.
Yeah.
And it's in one that I particularly right now have kind of a mid-level opinion of, where I don't dislike it, but I also don't really like it, but I also haven't seen it in a while. So
yeah.
It just struck me that, do you think maybe Tarantino borrowed that line for Kill Bill, the buck? Because one of the hospital interns says it to Uma Thurman.
Yeah, probably.
So I wonder if that's where he got the inspiration from, or if that was just a normal...
Probably. It's got to be.
It just struck me now. I never thought of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool.
So, Eaten Alive.
Eaten Alive.
All right. When you first said Eaten Alive, I thought you were talking the Lindsay one.
Oh, yeah. We'll see what my... I'm going to be revisiting that one soon. We'll see how that one goes.
All right. So for my third one, I picked what Josh knows I like is indie comedies.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a movie that was a cult smash when it came out in 2004. It's a movie called Napoleon Dynamite.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. It's a movie that I really didn't like the first time I saw it.
Yeah.
But then, for some reason, my friends wanted to watch it, and then it started to click when I understood that director Jared Hess was going for, which was he wanted it to be pretty dry. Like, the humor in this is super dry.
Right.
And when I first watched it, I was expecting, because at the time I saw it, it was already a cult hit. I was expecting it to be like this outrageous, over-the-top kind of comedy. Not this dry comedy that's just filled with weird moments. Like, this has weird moments. You know, it's got the main character is kind of this you know, nerdy loser who has to feed
not
a llama.
Kinda.
Well, he is. he has to feed a llama who lives on it, whose grandma owns. He's got an uncle who's like obsessed with football but sucks at football, played by John Grease. You got his brother who thinks he's a stud because he can like talk to women on the internet, and you know, he's trying to get this like Mexican kid nominated as class president. It's just a bunch of weird stuff going on through this whole movie, and I did not get it the first time I watched it.
Yeah.
And I've now seen it 10 to 12 times.
Really?
Yeah. And it still cracks me up. Which, you know, it's quite a feat considering that John Heder, who plays Napoleon Dynamite, got typecast after this movie big time. And also Jared Hess's follow-ups to this movie, like Nacho Libre, didn't work.
That was a bad movie.
Like, they just didn't work.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just, this is a movie that I had got forced to rewatch, and then I was like, okay, I get it now. And then I made a bunch of people watch it, and, you know, some of them hated me for it. Some people were on my level, and, you know, I think this is probably the most, you know, it was just a movie that I was like, automatically, I was like, oh yeah, Napoleon Dynamite. I hated that the first time I saw it.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, it's one of those comedies that I can watch whenever. If I'm flipping through channels and it's on TV, I'll stop and I'll watch it.
Wow.
So, only other thing I want to say is it's also the movie that made me like Jamiroquai because I really love the song Canned Heat and how it's used in this movie.
Jamiroquai.
Just saying, man. Okay. I like Jamiroquai. Virtual Insanity and Canned Heat? Come on. Come on, bring it home.
Okay.
You don't seem to really like this movie.
I don't like this movie.
Judging from the reaction you gave me when I said the title.
No, but you've made me think, okay, well, maybe I should watch it again.
You just got to realize that it's dry, and that's what they're going for.
Yeah.
And I think, like I said, I think I was looking for something that was more outrageous the first time I watched it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
We'll see.
We'll see. You won't watch it, but we'll see.
Might, you never know.
If I bring it over and drop it in that pile of movies in the other room on top of Half Past Dead, then maybe.
All right. Okay, so slasher movies. I am starting to like a lot of slasher movies that I maybe didn't.
Finally, you're coming around.
Didn't like so much when I saw them the first time.
Blood Rage. Listen to me on this.
I know. Okay, but one that did kind of stand out on this, I know, I feel like I'm kind of going with some obvious ones here, but again, like, I think one that I really kind of missed a lot of the, like, kind of strange overtones to it is Sleepaway Camp. I didn't, you know, it never really did anything for me, Sleepaway. Like, whenever I thought of 80s horror movies, I never even thought of Sleepaway Camp. And it was only when Scream Factory put it out again that I'm like, oh, I'll pick that up and check it out again. And, you know, because I knew Felissa Rose is obviously, you know, really kind of capitalized on the success of her part in this movie. And, you know, so I was like, well, it's got to have something going for it if she's this famous, like, again because of this. And yeah, I mean, from the opening scene where, like, you know, there's like, so the opening 5 minutes of this movie is just so weird because it's like this, like, these kids playing and then like their dad's with them, but it looks like he's gay or something. And then like the dad gets killed and then they're like with their like aunt who's
she's
like
fucking weird.
Totally like, I don't even know what the actor
is. We're going to Sleepaway Camp. You're going to have a good time at Sleepaway Camp, aren't you? I packed you a lunch.
Yeah, like, I don't even know what the actress is doing.
Desiree Gould's her name.
What's her name? Desiree Gould.
I think it's Desiree Gould.
Yeah. Gould, yeah, you're right.
And she's awesome in this.
Yeah, and then, you know, I mean, I think I saw it the first time before I saw Firstborn. So, I mean, now we've got Christopher Collette, who I love from Firstborn, as
hip
people know.
Hip anymore.
Yeah, and Manhattan Project.
Yep. Underrated 80s.
I never really got it with Ricky's character. Like, I just think a lot of the stuff kind of went past me. So watching this again now, I mean, the whole Ricky character in this movie is, again, just really kind of strange and, like, yelling and swearing and just acting really
odd. I'll
fucking
kill you!
Yeah. So, and, but super entertaining now. The villain girl, Judy, is just amazing. And, like, again, I just sort of went past me. I think because when I first saw this, I was just looking for tits and gore, and you know, seeing it now, I was, you know, you're kind of past that stuff. Well, sometimes. And when I watched it again, I was like, oh, there's just so much more going on here that's just kind of strange. And I just really got a kick out of it the on a recent viewing that I never got before.
It's funny because this was one of those movies that I loved the original artwork. With the sneaker on the bloody knife with the letter home to mom.
Yeah.
In the background saying, people are starting to get killed in that. And that, like the zombie VHS box.
Yeah.
That was one of those boxes where it's like, oh, I don't know if I want to watch that.
Yeah.
So it took me a long time to watch it. And like you, I've really learned over the years to appreciate the original Sleepaway Camp more than I used to, because now there's all the weird shit in it with, you know, the flashback to them seeing dad in bed with another man.
Oh, yeah.
All that just weird shit in it, you know, pedophile fucking
Oh, God.
You know,
so
all
gross.
That stuff. And the part with the boat where the guy's like, He's like, hey, Bobrina, and he's like hitting on the boat or whatever.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When he's like in the water.
And then the weird baseball game where, like, there's so much swearing and, like,
it just goes on forever because,
like,
it's
older
padding.
Kids being real jerks to, like, the younger kids. And there's just so many, like.
But the thing is, that whole baseball game is like padding. It's like 10 minutes that's not necessary.
But it's super entertaining.
Yeah. So it's got some nasty streak in it, too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it. I'm with you. Like, it's a movie that I really have grown over the years to like a lot more than I used to.
Yeah.
I didn't dislike it the first time I saw it, but it is one that's grown in stature for me, too, being a big slasher movie fan.
Yeah, like, I didn't dislike it either. It just never really made an impression.
Yeah.
And now I think it would probably be on a top five list of 80 slashers. Yeah.
Wow. I guess we'll find out when we do that episode.
Yeah, yes, we will.
And you know it'll be on mine. Blood Rage. You need to watch it, dude. Seriously.
I know.
All right. So here we get to my two that are going to make you go, what the fuck was
two
wrong
more,
with
right?
You?
Yeah, two more each.
You're going to be like, what the fuck was wrong with you, dude? Like, seriously. So my number, the Natural Born Killers, okay. 1994.
So I could see that. Yeah.
You could see that?
Yeah,
okay, I thought you'd think there was something wrong with me if I say that.
No, I'm actually thinking I might kind of feel the same way.
I didn't like this movie the first time I saw it. And the thing was, when this came out, you know, we were riding the wave of Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs. They'd said, this is based on a Quentin Tarantino story. So I was like, nice.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is directed by Oliver Stone. I'm like, I like Platoon. Let's check this out, right? The thing is, I think when I saw this movie originally, the satire on mass media didn't click with me as much as it should have. So I just thought it was just one of those movies that was like trying to be ultra violent as just for the sake of being ultra violent. I really wasn't into Woody Harrelson back then because he was on Cheers and I was like, yeah, Woody Harrelson, whatever. That guy can't act. And now I love Woody Harrelson. Like, he's like one of my favorites. Juliette Lewis, I've always kind of been hot or cold on because, you know, sucking on De Niro's thumb in Cape Fear and then doing a movie like Old School later. I'm kind of wishy-washy on her. And, you know, Rodney Dangerfield is like her, you know, molester dad that's staged like a sitcom.
Yeah.
There's just all sorts of weird shit in this movie. And I think that I was just so assaulted when I first saw it by all the like changes in colors and film stocks and all that kind of stuff that I didn't see it for what it was, which was a fucking brilliant satire on mass media and how we glorify killers in society, that they become more famous than they have any right to be.
Yeah.
And I think that message now works for this movie. I mean, the ultra violence stuff and all that in it is still fucking highly entertaining for what it is, but it's also got the message now that works for me. This is like a movie that's a trip, both literally and figuratively, because they're on a road trip and they're killing people on the road trip, but it's just a trip just watching this fucking movie because it's so out really there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's one that I definitely, when I rented the 2D, 2 VHS box set back in the day, couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
And now I think it's probably in one of Oliver Stone's best movies.
Yeah.
And also, recently, what made this pop on my mind is that I had recently read the book by, I think it's Jane Hasher is her name.
Yeah.
Where it's all about the making of Natural Born Killers because she was a producer on it.
Right.
And that really shined a light on this movie even more so because it was so in-depth in the production and the behind the scenes. So, yeah.
Natural
Born Killers.
I got to read that. And, it's such a... such an interesting movie. And
so, like, when you said you could see that, what do you mean?
Because I think when I saw it in the theater, I think I felt the same thing. Like, it was just one of those movies where I had no idea what to expect, and it was the Tarantino thing.
Yeah.
And this didn't, like, it didn't feel like a Tarantino movie, like, for starters. And it was just, it just felt, like, really all over the place. And I remember really loving, like, the stuff where, in the bar. Like, I really liked that part. But then when they got to the prison, I really... kind of was out of it,
right?
But now I like all that stuff too. Like, I really like the thing as a whole. I think kind of like weird is kind of like the, like, we've obviously learned to like weird as we get older, because
I guess,
yeah, like a lot of this stuff, like, we've been using that word a lot tonight, and I think it's really good. I'm never in a hurry to watch it. Like, I'm never like, oh, I really want to watch that tonight, but when I it's definitely one where I when I see it pop up, or if it showed up on Netflix or something, I'd probably hit play, you know.
Nice.
Yeah. The only downfall, I think, is Downey in that movie. He's a little weak. Yeah. Yeah, but it's still a pretty fun flick and a great soundtrack. Okay.
Yes, it does have a good soundtrack.
So I'm going to go back to Scream Factory territory, because they brought out another one that I just loathed when I was young, and that's Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, that I have really come around on.
I should have known.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
You and everybody else, Josh. You and everybody else.
And I don't
else.
Know. Well, I'm not the contrarian who's always against everyone. Well,
for once, you're not.
Yes. It is really fun. And have you watched the Scream Factory release?
I haven't watched the Scream Factory release, but I have seen the movie not that long ago.
Yeah.
I always kind of found Season of the Witch to be entertaining on its own right. I've always said that if they would have not put the Halloween moniker on it, it probably wouldn't have been hated for as long as it was. Because it's an entertaining B-movie. It really is.
Well, I should, like, I don't know how much I really like the movie, to be honest. But fucking Tom Atkins' performance in this movie.
Well, there's moments in this movie, too.
There's some moments, but it's Atkins' performance and just how how this guy is like a total womanizer makes no sense. And it's just funny, and he's just got such swagger in this movie, and it's just a lot of fun to watch now. But you got to take yourself totally out of the whole Michael Myers.
Yeah,
like, you don't look at this as part of the franchise even, but it's...
Well, I think that's what hurt it.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
I mean, they should have just released a movie called Season of the Witch.
Yeah.
And not had the Halloween 3 in front of it.
I still don't know how well it would have done, but it's a pretty wacky movie.
It probably wouldn't have been a movie that everyone was like, fuck that movie, for like 20 years before... You know, Scream Factory put it out on Blu-ray, and everyone's like, hey, I like this movie.
Like, I don't know how that happened, but, I guess it's a lot of it's just us appreciating, I mean, again, like, just some of the weird strangeness of of the 80s, but, I mean, this is a strange movie. And,
dude, I gotta tell you, the scene with the microchip
yeah,
in the hotel room still fucking grosses me out.
Like, the...
the lady who gets shot in the mouth with the laser beam.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That grosses me the fuck out still. And it did even when the movie originally came out.
Yeah, it's just such a, like, scare. Or Atkins' performance is just so over the top. And then the plot is just so out there. Like, it's just.
We're going to take pieces of Stonehenge to put into Halloween masks to kill children. You're welcome.
Yeah, like, it's just. You got to give props for this thing even getting made. So. It's definitely worth another look.
Yeah. All right. So my final selection.
All right.
And here it goes. And this is a movie that I will probably be raked over the coals for because, you know, people will think I'm crazy, but I really didn't like The Hitcher the first time I saw it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The 1986 classic, The Hitcher, starring C. Thomas Howell, Rutger Hauer, and JJL, Jennifer Jason Leigh, never bad.
Yep.
And I didn't like it the first time I saw it, and I can't really explain to you why that is, because it's a badass fucking movie.
Yeah,
I think it's just because I was expecting something different, maybe, because there are moments in this movie that feel like an action movie more than a horror movie.
Right,
like there's the whole chase with the jeeps and stuff, like the police jeep.
God, I haven't seen this in so
long. And I'm just like, what the hell is this? This is supposed to be about a psycho killer. Why is there a jeep chase in the middle of this movie? Right? But now, I really think that Rutger Hauer gives one of the best villain performances of any 80s movie.
Right.
And probably in the top 50 villain performances of all time.
Mm.
I think C. Thomas Howell, I always remembered him from like movies like Soul Man and stuff like that. So I never thought of him outside of comedies. And I think he handles himself really well here.
Yeah.
And of course, Jennifer Jason Leigh, she's my girl.
Yeah.
She's great in this. And she, you know, she has one of the most intense, wrenching scenes in the entire movie.
Yeah.
And this is a movie that just propels from the get-go. It just... straight line, keeps moving, fast paced, tense as hell right from the get go, right from the opening scene where, you know, he's hitchhiking and C. Thomas Howell picks up Rutger Hauer and he's like, I killed the family and all that stuff. Right from there, you're just like, okay, tense, I'm in. Very memorable moments in this, you know, the opening, like I said, the scene with the French fries, which everybody remembers, and of course the Jennifer Jason Leigh stuff. And it's just a really muscular, macho kind of horror movie that just worms its way under your skin and creeps you the fuck out, but still has action elements to kind of like quicken the pace at times. It's definitely Eric Red's finest work, apart from Near Dark, obviously, which he wrote. But it's his finest work, and for fuck's sake, please avoid the sequel, people. Don't watch The Hitcher 2. I've been waiting. Please don't watch it.
I think I've watched it. Oh. And the remake.
Yeah, the remake's not as bad as the sequel.
Yeah.
But the remake, the thing about the remake is the gender reversal didn't work for the most part. And as much as Sean Bean tries, he's no Rutger.
No.
Like, he's okay as the bad guy in it.
Yeah.
But for the entire time, I'm like, I want Rutger.
Yeah.
I really just want Rutger right now.
Yeah.
And that was its detractor. So, yeah, The Hitcher's my top choice for ones that I didn't like the first time through.
Nice.
So.
I thought you said, yeah, they were ranked.
Well, you know what I mean. The last choice, I said.
You said the top choice.
Well, whatever. I didn't really rank them. I think The Hitcher's the one that's going to get me the most flack.
Okay. Well, I'm going to put it as my last choice, the entire fucking Coen Brothers filmography. But
what?
I hate every Coen Brothers movie until I watch it a second time.
I thought you only had one negative.
Huh?
I thought you only had one negative.
I'm not. I'm saying positive.
Oh, okay, okay.
So the Coen Brothers, every one of their movies that I've seen, I did not like the first time. And I therefore have not seen most of their movies because...
You're fucking crazy. I just got to say that now.
I'm serious. And like, this is, but I think this is kind of a thing. I don't think I'm the only person who feels this way. But when I do watch them a second time, I do like, so the one I'm bringing up is Big Lebowski.
Yep.
Couldn't stand it when I first saw it. but I have learned to understand what the appeal is and do quite like it. And I do look forward to watching it again. Couldn't stand it the first time I saw it. And I think most of their movies are like that. And I can't even think of a lot of Coen Brothers movies right now, but like, I didn't like Raising Arizona.
I think you'd like Raising Arizona now.
Yeah, I just watched it recently for the first time. Didn't like it.
Oh, really?
Didn't like No Country for Old Men. Didn't like True Grit. Didn't like... Wow. What's the other one? Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? I kind of like that one, but yeah, I just really don't like
their
stuff.
Dude, you should watch like Blood Simple, seriously.
Didn't like Blood Simple.
Really?
Yeah, but my point here is I do feel like every one of their movies I will like a lot more on a second viewing.
Right.
With a few years in between. And I really honestly believe that. So I was going to go out with a negative on this, on my last choice here, but I did decide to throw in this thing. I mean, Big Lebowski is the movie I'm choosing because I have really learned to like it and really understand how quotable it is and how unique it is. And I really do enjoy that movie now. But I really do honestly believe that I think most of their filmography I will like more the second time. Like Hail Caesar, I can look at it and I'm like, I'm going to hate this. But I'll bet you if I watch it and then wait 3 years and watch it again, I'll really like it.
Hmm.
It's been like kind of a thing with those filmmakers and me.
It's funny that you're saying The Big Lebowski, because I know that The Big Lebowski is the one that is their most popular movie because it's got the biggest cult following, but that's not even close to being my favorite Coen Brothers movie.
I don't know if that's their most popular.
Well, I think it's the one that's the most culty and, you know, famous.
Yeah, anyway. I mean, I think No Country for Old Men would arguably...
For serious films, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely their most popular.
I like No Country
for... And it was an Oscar winner, right?
Well, I like No Country for Old Men more than I like Big Lebowski. I like Raising Arizona more. I like Blood Simple more.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, I like Big Lebowski, but yeah, it's weird that you... I know you don't like them, and I think you should maybe... Give them another shot.
Yeah, I just feel like every one of their movies I need to watch at least two or three times.
Huh.
And kind of like you with The Matrix or with sci-fi, right? I mean, they're kind of like my sci-fi. Like, I feel like every one of their movies, I'm going to not like it the first time. But if I watch it a few times, I probably will. I just don't have the patience or I feel like the time to be sitting there watching movies over and over again.
You don't even like Fargo.
Oh, I don't like Fargo. No.
Wow.
No, I don't like Fargo at all.
Wow.
But I think I might if I watched it again. But yeah, I couldn't really stand it the first time. Yeah, every one of their movies. I'm not kidding you. Every single one of their movies.
Because it's funny, though, because like I'm a fan of their movies and I like their movies and I make an effort to go see every one of their movies in theaters.
Yeah.
But I didn't go see Hail Caesar. Because I was just like, I don't know about this one, so...
Well, what's interesting is that one looks like the one I'd probably like the most.
Huh.
But I never saw it, because, I'm like, Coen Brothers, it's an immediate turnoff for me.
Right.
But I do feel like, honestly, like, I think about their movies. I know they're good filmmakers. Like, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying their movies are shit. I'm just saying, particularly for me, I've really found with them, it's got to be multiple viewings, or I just don't like it. And I can almost guarantee you anything I watch by them, I'm not going to like, but I probably will on repeat viewings.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
Anyway, that's it.
That's all. I was thinking about having some honorable mentions, but I'm not going to bother because I don't remember them all. So should we recap or should we just go with it?
We can recap if you want.
Okay. Well. I said Goonies, Matrix, Napoleon Dynamite, Natural Born Killers, and The Hitcher.
And I said Street Trash, Eaten Alive, Sleepaway Camp, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, and Big Lebowski.
Nice. So if you'd like to share your choices with us, typical spiel here at the end, search for GBW Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, follow us there. If you're feeling generous, go to iTunes, rate us and review us. But the most important thing, as always, is spread the word. So if you like the show and you like what you're hearing and you think more people would dig what we're throwing down, tell them about it. Yeah. Get them to listen. That's all we ask.
If you see someone posting on Facebook, what movie podcast should I listen to? throw our name out there.
Yeah. If you see someone being like, hey, I want to talk, I want to hear about the most, some of the most obscure 70s and 80s movies that I don't know about, talk about GBW Podcast. Do it. Send it out there. I'm pretty sure we've covered some movies that no one's heard of before.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's it. So hopefully you guys enjoyed this one. And next time we're talking Never Bad. And that's it for tonight.
That's right. We're leaving the motherfucking house.